Good evening. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm taking the seat here, the driver's seat, while Rick celebrates his birthday. He's home, preparing for Mother's Day. I'm certain he said he's just going to give her the money to go get a massage and keep the kids out of her hair. But first of all, the fabulous kids, so I think they'd be a lot of fun to play with, and he's really just giving himself a present. But on top of that, I'm pretty sure he's probably doing some other nice things for a wonderful woman, Rick's wife. The number here, 1-888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. We're going to chat up a whole pile of stuff. First of all, if you're traveling in the Harrisburg area, that big explosion that happened from the fuel truck, the lanes are open again. I don't know. Did you see the video on TV? It was absolutely amazing. You could kind of see the truck that was burning, and then you see it exploding a couple of times. I'm sure whoever was shooting that video had a little adrenaline in their body. But on top of that, then, like, the oil had just spread. It was diesel fuel, I guess, just spread the length of the highway on this overpass, and it was just burning the length of the highway, and you could see fire trucks from below spraying up at it, and, you know, heaven help us if we didn't have firefighters that were willing to take chances like that. I don't know what that's going to do to that ramp. I imagine even though 81 is open, I imagine that ramp will be closed for a while. But quite an amazing explosion, and miraculously, remarkably, and thankfully, the driver got out okay. Probably not a great, not great hope for his career continuing in any sort of truck driving fashion, but I can't imagine insurance companies are crazy about stuff like that when it happens. But the pictures are just astounding. USA Today has the video, as well as, I think, just about every other news organization in the country. This is the Rick Smith Show. If you think he sounds a little funny tonight, that's because my name is Pat LaMarche, and I'm filling in for him. I'm going on a trip with these guys. They're traveling the United States on the People's Tour of America. People's Tour of America or For America, Brett? For America. Brett is taking care of me, and you know, kudos to Brett. That's not a job a whole pile of people were clamoring to take. But we are going to all set off together, Brett, Rick, and I, along with Rick's family. And we're going to travel the United States. It'll be about 5 weeks in total. We leave in just under a month. And we'll spend a little bit of time in New York City and then head on out from there. We're going to talk with a few people tonight about some different issues. One of them, though, coming up at 9:30, Jesse Johnson, who's an activist with the West Virginia Mountain Party, because one of our first stops is going to be at Blair Mountain in Logan County, West Virginia. And if you don't know what Blair Mountain is, you're going to want to listen at 9:30. Blair Mountain was the site of the largest armed insurrection except for the Civil War in the United States. What happened was a whole pile of mine workers were a little sick of how they were being treated. They went on strike. The coal companies hired mercenaries for hire police departments and started killing the miners. And basically, war broke out between these hired guns and the miners. And it was not until the president called in special troops, the military, the United States military, that the miners stood down. And the reason the miners stood down was because they were the true patriots, not the hired guns that were trying to kill them. They were bombing these miners. They actually, the hired guns for the coal companies had airplanes, and they were bombing United States citizens for wanting the right to organize, wanting the right to have their own domain over their own lives, not to die in the coal mines. And but when the U.S. military showed up, the miners said, "We won't shoot members of our own U.S. military," and the miners stood down. That site, Blair Mountain, is at risk right now. The company that owns Blair Mountain intends to make it the next mountaintop removal site. I was there last month. I'm a contributor to the Huffington Post. If you go to thehuffingtonpost.com/Pat-LaMarche, you can read my stories. And one of them, just about 3 or 4 weeks ago, was about Blair Mountain in West Virginia and the things that are going on there. We're going to talk to Jesse Johnson. He's been fighting to save the mountains for a couple of decades now. He says it's ground zero on the environmental movement, ground zero on the labor movement, ground zero on just about everything. And so we're going to chat with that. There are sane, rational ways to get the coal out of the ground. You leave the mountain in place. You put in a mine. You obey the rules. You keep the miners safe. You extract the resource. And that's how you do it. You don't blow them out in the kingdom come. When I was down there, they had cemeteries. And they had, you know, cemeteries all over the mountainsides. And I'm not from, basically I'm from Maine. And we have a couple of mountains. But we don't have mountainside graveyards. One of the graveyards I went to visit was the graveyards of the Hatfields, of the famous Hatfields and McCoys. And the McCoys from your area, I think, Brett, Kentucky. But the Hatfields were from West Virginia. And the Hatfields were all buried on the side of this extremely, just incredibly steep mountainside. And these graveyards that are on the mountainside, when the mountaintop removal happens, I never thought about what happened to the graveyards. It never even dawned on me that something might happen to the graveyards. I just assumed you don't blow up graveyards. You put the dearly departed in the hollowed ground, you leave them there. That was my understanding. That is just not true. What they do in West Virginia is they take the gravestones, they set them down on the side of the road. If you want to come get Aunt Mildred's gravestone or Uncle Frank, you come pick up the gravestone, bam, blow the living daylights out of the graveyard. And then, you know, wrist bones or whatever happens ends up, along with all the rest of the detritus from the mountain, the chipmunks and the worms and the trees and everything else that gets blown into the ravines, clogging the rivers. That is what's happening to the graveyards as well, and I had no idea. And then there are graveyards that are preserved, and you can see those too. If you go online, you can look at pictures of mountaintop removal from West Virginia, and you can see that there are these long pillars of mountain left, like singular, like almost like a Dr. Seuss picture of this long pillar of a mountain, a little tiny graveyard at the top, and then all the rest of the mountain taken away around it. So if you go to my story, you can click on some of the links, and you'll hear, read the testimony from different people who talk about going to the graveyard to see their loved one and the graveyard just falling away under their feet because the mountain around it has been removed. So, you know, I mean, they don't care about the resource. They don't care about the natural resource. The people of West Virginia are desperate. They think it's all they have. Quite frankly, even the labor unions have, in some cases, bought into the idea that mountaintop removal is all they have for jobs. That's just not true. It's like in Maine, where I come from, the loggers believe that they have to clear cut because it's all they can have for jobs. And sustainable logging makes many more jobs, just like deep coal mining makes many more jobs. So there are alternatives, and Jesse Johnson and the other folks fighting to save Blair Mountain want to remind people of that. A lot of stories to talk about there. I was going to mention a trip I went on that was similar to the trip that we are going on, the People's Tour for America. And it was last January and February. I went on a tour that we called the Babes of Wrath Tour. We took Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and modeled our tour after the trip that the fictitious family took, the Jodes. The Jodes, if you read the book, which most of us had to read in high school, so if you read the Cliff Notes, you know that the Jodes were forced to leave because of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression and the bankers taking back the land. They were forced to leave their homes, and they headed to California to find a better way of life. Of course, not finding it because the Great Depression hurt everybody, sort of like what's happening right now in this country, the class of poor getting larger and larger. The problem is we don't have the safeguards being put into place that they did when the New Deal happened. But they made this trip. And so Diane Nyland, a dear friend of mine, and the founder and chief executive officer of Hear Us, hearus.us, which is a organization to help homeless children across the country, she and I took this trip, and we called ourselves the Babes of Wrath, kind of for fun. And Diane was going to join us tonight. She was going to talk about that and kind of set up what our trip will be like when we do this this upcoming trip, the People's Tour for America. But very suddenly, Diane's mom died today. And so our thoughts go with Diane, and my heart goes out to Diane. She's a wonderful woman. Her mother loved her an awful lot. And just like my mom did and everybody's mom. And it's an awful club you join when your mom dies. And unfortunately, Diane joined that club today. But she was going to join us. She was going to talk about the Babes of Wrath Tour. We had an incredible time. We saw some amazing things. We did the Deep Southwest, which was pretty different from what we're going to be doing. I know we're headed down through the south, but then we're coming back much further north and going to go into Ohio and Missouri and a lot further north than we did when we came back. It was interesting when we took off on the trip. I flew into Little Rock, Arkansas, and Diane met me there, also traveling in a little RV. And we went to the Clinton Library. Now, you know, I did the stuff I'm sure every middle-aged woman does when she got to the Clinton Library and stumbled upon the fact that Bill Clinton and the Clinton Library has rebuilt the Oval Office. An exact replica of the Oval Office is in the Clinton Library. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. So everything, the carpeting, the head of Abe Lincoln, there's a Abe Lincoln, not his real head, the like a bust of Abe Lincoln, all this stuff that's in the Oval Office and all the filigree and the fancy pants couches and all the really cool things, the big old desk with the special panels, really interesting sort of intricacies, that's all there. So I, like most any woman would who's lived through the scandals of the Bill Clinton era, I go up to the security guard and ask him if I could just get my picture taken sort of crouched down behind the desk. But, yeah, no, wouldn't let me. I couldn't even go in the room, really. It was all roped off. You just get to look at it. But it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to see the replica of the Oval Office. I tried, Lord knows, myself to get closer to the White House by running for vice president, but it wasn't meant to be. Anyway, so from there we went, and it's an interesting library because, you know, remember how Bill Clinton kept talking about the bridge to the 21st century? We're going to build the bridge to the 21st century. Well, this library basically stretches halfway out across the Arkansas River. So you've got the building that's the library, but then it's got sort of this huge piece of it that's all glassed in, and you can walk out halfway across the river as though it's the bridge to something. Of course, the George Bush administration took over, and whatever the bridge was supposed to go to. Right around the time My Little Goat, or The Little Goat, or whatever book he was reading in the schoolhouse happened, well, whatever intention we had for bringing the 20th century into the 21st century, I guess you can argue that the bloodshed and murder of the 20th century was just destined to be continued once George Bush took over. But so that interesting library, that's where we started. We moved on. We went through Oklahoma, Texas. We'll be doing that again. We are going to head down to Waco and to West Texas. Going to see the big crater where negligence and on both the part of a corporation, but also on the part of a ill-suited local government, really not suited to monitoring the greed, quite frankly, the lack of concern for the worker that existed there, and who knows at how many other places across Texas. Certainly the sites that are toxic waste dumps, one would really have to worry about what's going on there and how the people fare. The Native American reservations that are located by these waste dumps and bedding aren't terribly protected by the same government that didn't protect the workers in West Texas. We're going to head from there and keep going west. We're going to interview all kinds of folks from all different types of unions, and I'll be writing a book on the history of the labor movement at the same time that we are putting together 3-hour broadcasts from the road that you'll be able to hear right here. And that's all pretty exciting, and I'm really very grateful that I'm being included in this trip. So my name's Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith tonight while he's off for a couple of days. He is celebrating his birthday, among other things. And we'll be getting to know each other better as time goes by because we're going to go on this great trip together. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of The Rick Smith Show coming up. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. We're on the road to nowhere. Hey, hey. We're on the road to nowhere. Hey.
bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The People's Movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is Justice for Working People Facing Foreclosure. Action this week focused on Bank of America. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bankruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is, and working to take back the city, because it's ours.
Some U.S. Airways mechanics and related workers have filed with the National Mediation Board for an election to be represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. There are 4,000 mechanics at U.S. Airways. Those workers are currently represented by the International Association of Machinists. The Teamsters will also soon file to represent more than 11,000 mechanics and related workers at American Airlines. The two airlines are merging. The Louisiana Supreme Court has found the state's funding for its school voucher program is unconstitutional. The suit was brought by the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the decision is a, quote, stinging rebuke of Governor Bobby Jindal's agenda to strip Louisiana public schools of the resources they desperately need, end quote. In a class action lawsuit against Integrity Staffing Solutions, Amazon.com warehouse workers are seeking compensation for showing the company they aren't thieves. At the end of each workday, Amazon workers must pass through a security checkpoint where they're searched for stolen goods. The workers claim that the security checkpoints take place after they've already clocked out for the day and can take as much as 25 minutes. The employees are seeking compensation for the unpaid time spent in the checkpoints. Last week, Hawaii granted new workplace protections to domestic workers, and today Oregon is on the path to do the same. Jesse Russell reports.
A bill narrowly passed Oregon's House that would grant more workplace protections to domestic workers. Some of the items in the bill include paying workers overtime for working more than 40 hours per week or 44 hours per week if they live in the home of their employer. It expands protections against sexual harassment and guarantees workers 8 hours of sleep and at least 24 hours of consecutive rest. Employers will also be required to provide 3 personal days for domestic employees after they've worked at the home for 1 year. The bill additionally prevents employers from holding a worker's passport.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day, and we got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
A Black Panther standing guard. I guess I can't talk because I'm a racist, and anything I say is going to give that away. So, is all I have to contribute. I'm a paid television professional from Fox News, so no one really expects anything much more intelligent. A black guy standing by a door has to be guarding it. What's the dude's name that saved the 3 women in Cleveland or wherever?
Charles Ramsey.
Oh, Charles Ramsey. Okay, so Charles Ramsey, his line, the only reason a cute white lady ran to a black man's arms is because she was running away from something. I got news for you. Two words. Denzel Washington. There isn't a white woman in this country that wouldn't run into his arms, so that's just all crap. But aside from that, it turns out that blacks voted at higher rates than whites in 2012. That's good news. As long as you don't mind the fact that all your white brothers and sisters are sitting around doing nothing. Well, not all of them, but fewer percentage have decided to go to the polls and do something positive. For the first time ever, the 2012 election, this is according to the United States Census Bureau, the 2012 election produced another demographic milestone in the changing face of the nation as African Americans voted at a higher rate than whites for the first time. The report provided fresh evidence of how higher turnout rates among African Americans and the rapidly growing Hispanic population continue to reshape the electorate in presidential elections. You know, the people who really ought to be reading this probably aren't listening to this show, and that's people like, oh, I don't know. What's that guy's name with the dog on his roof again? Romney? You know, these are the people who have absolutely no qualms about insulting and degrading people of color. And the fact that the people of color actually still believe in democracy ought to be scaring the living daylights out of them. The report found that both blacks and Hispanics voted in higher raw numbers in 2012 than in 2008, propelling President Obama to a re-election victory over Republican Mitt Romney, as did common sense. That was the other propellant. Now, in the meantime, no good deed goes unpunished, so the president has decided to punish us all by starting arguments out of the blocks are cutting Social Security. Everybody says, well, he has to give in eventually. Give in eventually? How about trying to do the right thing at the beginning before you end up giving in on anything? The total number of white voters actually decreased between 2008 and 2012, the first such drop by any group within this population since the Bureau started keeping these statistics in 1996. So the first time since basically the re-election of Bill Clinton that the number of white voters has fallen off. So that's something that, you know, white voters might want to think about. It may not necessarily be a good idea that we don't vote anymore, unless those voters are racists and some of the other problems that plague, to some degree, the white people. And I'm not saying you can't have people of color that are racists. I'm just saying that, you know, well, the guy from Ohio that ran for office dressed in his Nazi uniform, white guy. Just saying. We're going to go to the phones. The phone number, of course, 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. Now, if I can do this, can I do this? I can do this, can't I? Hi, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, thanks, Pat, and I want to welcome you to your own show, and I wanted to congratulate you on your pace and rhythm. You're very easy to listen to.
You're
very relaxed tonight, and you're very well informed.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, Pat, and I appreciate you. I know you're a busy person stepping up to help the show tonight. On a personal note, I happen to be a third-generation union person. My grandfather was president of the National League Umpires Union.
Wow. Did you get tickets to games?
Actually, we didn't even need a ticket. He would show up with his gold, literally, it's a gold credit card given to retired umpires, and he would just show them at the window. We would always get nice seats, but my father and I never took advantage of that, and nor did Grandpa Barlick. He's in Cooperstown. And then he had been a coal miner, and then my dad was the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees Union, also carried an IBEW card for probably between the two of them, I would say 40 years. And then myself, I spent my adult life, half of my adult life in the Marine Corps out of respect, ironically, to the union, because I wanted to make sure that when I approached the union that I was well trained and had paid my dues to our country. And then when I got out in my very early 30s, I didn't realize while I was in there my country had been given away. So it's been a real shock to me. I have a young sounding voice, but I am a grandfather. I'm a little nervous, but and I also I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, and I'm a Desert Storm veteran, but I'm a very proud union member. I belong to the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. But Pat, I was just going to ask you, maybe not in this book, but will you touch either in your book or on the tour the Sacklin Vanzetti case? Also, as you go west, will you be looking at Ludlow and the hanging of Joe Hill? And also being an Illinois native, will you touch on what happened at the Haymarket Square? I'll hang up and continue to listen to your show. You're very good on the radio. I'm already attached to your voice. You're doing great.
Thanks, Mark. I've been in broadcasting for about 20 years, so I'm glad, I'm glad it might show a little. But hey, don't go away yet.
Hey, Pat, you're cheating. You're so good.
But don't go away yet. Though. First of all, we've got Ludlow definitely is already on the tour list. The Sacco and Vanzetti in Haymarket, I'll check on. Please email us, or you, Mark, and everyone else, email us with ideas, and you know, because we're all so absolutely convinced we know what we're doing, but we don't want to leave important things out. You know, you're staring at one part of the picture, and the whole other part of the picture goes right by you.
Well, just on that note, I'll make it quick and get out of here because I may have a guest coming up, Pat. But speaking of going west, I worked at the nuclear power plants out in California. When I left, I saw I had time to hit. There's the Steinbeck Museum, which is very, very labor-intensive coverage there. It's not Monterey. Maybe it's just outside of Monterey, actually. But and yeah.
It's in Salinas. Yeah.
There you go. Oh, see, you know, Pat. But anyway, I'm a blue collar guy, so I'm learning.
So was Steinbeck, and you know, it was really funny. The other day, a guy said to me, he said, because I write all this political stuff, right? He said, you know, I love the stuff you write. I really do. You're a ballsy girl. You know that? You know, you're a regular Gloria Steinbeck.
I think that was John's wife, Gloria. I think they were the Steinbeck. Kind of like Eleanor and Franklin. Yeah. Anyway, and he was probably a fan of Archie Bunker's too.
Did have a little bit of that voice, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
all right,
you make...
Matt. Well, I'll hang up because it's more exciting to listen to you over the air, and you're doing a great job. Obviously, you know that, but we're very lucky to have you, the whole country needs to be educated to what we're on the brink of losing right now, and I think voices like our own are the folks that are hanging in there together. So
wonderful, you're right, Mark. You're right, and Mark's making it a great example. Take Mark's example all through tonight and make a phone call and join the show. We'd love to have you. Thanks for the call, Mark. You know, he made a point though too that really struck home with me. And I really hadn't examined that much of this because my time as a journalist and as a broadcaster, I've really worked on poverty issues. And, of course, we'd have an awful lot more poverty throughout the U.S. history if it hadn't been for labor unions. We would certainly have what so many people are trying to bring us back to, which is a lack of overtime pay. We'd have kids in the workplace. You know, I love it when people like Michelle Bachmann, who has to, like, go home and hit her head against the wall because there's no other way you're going to be that stupid. When Michelle Bachmann says, oh, my God, guess what? We could get rid of the minimum wage and everybody would have a job. Like, it doesn't happen anywhere. Michelle, you don't have to experiment with the United States. You can visit Haiti. There are places you can get exactly what you want. In fact, I invite you to go down to Haiti for a few months and maybe help some people. Maybe that would help Michelle Bachmann understand better what the plight of people is like who don't have effective organizations and organizing to help the worker. But one of the things that Mark just triggered in my mind that I had forgotten about was my mom's family is all Irish immigrants. And my uncles wouldn't have had decent paying jobs without labor unions. And, you know, they were poorly educated, wonderful people. They had kids. They had families. They were able to feed them and raise them and care for them and educate them. My cousins and everyone in my family, everybody went to college. But certainly not my uncle's generation, my mom's generation. And my mom went to college when I was in high school and ended up as a member of a labor union working as an accountant. After she got her CPA, working as an accountant, as a member of the state labor union, and a governor got into office that decided to furlough the state workers as a way to balance the budget. And so my mom ends up getting days without pay. And I remember her being furious and saying, you know, my mom as an auditor for the state actually brought in money. So what they did was they furloughed her on days so that she couldn't make money for the state, which was even stupider. You know, balancing the budget on the backs of the unionized workers that worked for the state. And that sort of stuff happens all the time. And I do appreciate your call, Mark. Thanks for calling. The number, and we do have a guest coming. Jesse Johnson is going to join us at 9:30. But the number here is 888-520-7425, 520-RICK. Give us a call and join the show throughout the show. And every guest I have on tonight is pretty much going to be willing to have a chat with you as well. They don't just need to speak to me. We can make this go two or three ways around. I have spent a lot of time in broadcasting. I'm glad it shows, Mark. But most recently, I worked for a number of radio stations up in Maine. I worked for Stephen King, who owns stations up there. Fabulous guy, wonderful man, and certainly a huge supporter of a decent living wage for everybody in the country, and wrote some great scathing stuff about Romney. Check it out online. If you can, just Google Stephen King and Romney, and all kinds of fun stuff will come up. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Jesse Johnson of the Mountain Party in West Virginia, and we're going to talk about Blair Mountain. We'll be right back with more of the Rick Smith Show coming up.
Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Amy Meyer was curious. Then she was appalled. Then she was charged with the crime of using a cell phone to video what appalled her. Welcome to the brave new world of ag laws being pushed by agribusiness corporations to stop reporters, workers, animal rights advocates, and even curious 25-year-old truth seekers like Miss Meyer from recording abuses that are routinely taking place on farm animal confinement factories. Actually, these are the repressive laws of the cowardly new world of industrial ag biz, eager to keep its customers in the dark about what they're doing to the pigs, cows, chickens, etc. under their care. A resident of Utah, which passed its gag law last year, Meyer heard about some ugly doings at the Smith & Sons meatpacking outfit in the town of Draper City, so she decided to take a look. Even from the public roadway where she stood, the horror was easy to see, and she dared to document it with her camera. The corporate manager scrambled out to declare that she was trespassing, later claiming that she had crossed a barbed wire fence onto corporate property. Cops were called, no such trespass was found, and she was released. But the corporation, whose owner just happens to be mayor of Draper, got city prosecutors to charge her with, ready? Agricultural operation interference, punishable by a 6-month jail term. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, thanks to a web alert by Will Potter, author of a blog named GreenIsTheNewRed.com, global public outrage poured into Draper City, and in just 24 hours, prosecutors dropped all charges against Meyer, the first person in America to be charged under these ridiculous laws. Thanks to stand-up rebels like Amy, Will, and thousands of freedom defenders, AgBiz is chugging on its own ag-gag scam. To help fight it, go to change.org/ag-gag.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Pat Lamar, sitting in for Rick Smith on The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to the program. The number is, we're going to talk to Jesse for a little bit, and then we're going to take your calls. And I know Jesse Johnson very well. He's an old pro, so he can handle your calls as well. The number 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. And we've got a whole lineup of very interesting guests. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to talk with Laurel Krauss. Her sister, Allison Krauss, was one of the four dead at Ohio. Her sister was killed by the Ohio National Guard 43 years ago this past Saturday. And I interviewed her last week for a story that appeared in the Huffington Post about the United Nations. They're going to be taking a look at, which is great news, the United Nations is going to be taking a look at whether or not the FBI, in fact, had those four kids killed and the nine others wounded. Greg DeCoy, who's a blog radio host and a very active politico down in South Carolina, going to talk to us about their brand new congressman. When he's not in Argentina and when he used to be governor, but now congressman, coming up in South Carolina. And then John Atkinson, a great fellow, talking to us from Nebraska later at 11 o'clock. About global climate change and what that means for, well, for the rest of us. But first, Jesse Johnson, two-time candidate for governor, Mountain Party candidate for governor of West Virginia, and longtime activist trying to save the mountains for West Virginia and for the rest of the world, because the Appalachian Mountains, the oldest mountain range in the world, that's why they're so short. Worn down, but they're beautiful mountains full of all kinds of natural resources that, well, quite frankly, nobody wants to work too hard to get at anymore. They just have to blow the tops off and scoop the insides out. Jesse, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Thank you so much.
How you doing?
I've been a little under the weather, but I'm hanging in there and keep working, keep fighting.
Keep finding good. Well, I hope you feel better soon. Jesse, I was there with you about a month ago, and actually the story I wrote about the West Virginia mountains is the received more likes than any story I have ever written for the Huffington Post. I mean, people are really upset and concerned about mountaintop removal, and of course what it means that the next mountain on the list to go is Blair Mountain. Can you, first of all, tell us a little bit about how mountaintop removal works?
Well, mountaintop removal is the most cost-effective for the coal operators and their extra supporters who are in the business of exportation of coal, which this year, as last year, were record years for export of coal at the same time of having the least amount of workers on the job, union workers in particular. But mountaintop removal is, you know, making money. It's about getting that coal by the means of using the least amount of workers as possible, and that's exactly what they do. And they've actually worked it into a program with the pensions of the UMWA to the point where the UMWA does not even get too upset about the fact that they're using some non-union there.
What does this mean? This means that that part of the profit from mountaintop removal is how they fund the pension system?
Yes, that changed in the early 90s, and unfortunately it's...
That was diabolical, wasn't it?
Yes, you'll find that in Washington from time to time. but as well as your local state house, most of the time these days. But anyway... you know, mountaintop removal is just devastation. It's really, truly decimation in the sense that you're not only removing the coal and pushing the overburden, as they call the toxic, then toxic rubble, into the valleys, which covers the streams and headwaters to most of the water that ends up providing potable drinking water to, almost two-thirds of our population of the nation, and certainly everything east of the Mississippi. The Appalachian Mountain Range supplies that. The thing with mountaintop removal is that the most of that being done today is going after coal. Much of it is being sent to China to provide steel-making jobs for the Chinese that we sent over there so that they can send... you know, sell us back inferior non-union, non-American made steel. It's, like I said, it's decimation. It's that we've really cannibalizing ourselves with these processes for the extraction of fossil fuels. The mountaintop removal is also just a decimation of community, and you saw yourself the community of Blair, and which now is, what, maybe 24, 25 homes. Used to be over 500 families there.
Now, let's talk a little bit about that phenomenon, because that was remarkable. And quite frankly, Jesse, when you would tell me these stories, I feel bad that we're now doing this to everybody listening. You would tell me these stories, and I couldn't conceive of what you were talking about until I actually saw it with my own eyes. It we would drive through communities where houses had burned down, and but there were old abandoned homes, and some homes looked abandoned. Some homes looked abandoned, and they weren't, which was even more horrifying. But there stuff was decaying and burned down. But in the town of Blair, there's this plan to make it look like nobody was ever there. So once they get people out of their homes, they literally go in, dismantle the home, and remove it. So it looks like it wasn't a town.
Right. The same thing with the, you know, the supermarket and the high schools and all of that that used to be supporting that area. This is fairly commonplace in the southern coal fields and has been going on, you know, with mountaintop removal, and particularly with whenever I ran in the 2010 U.S. Senate campaign against Joe Manchin, I had on my website the depopulation plan that the coal companies had put together for southern West Virginia. And basically, you know, now it's that on steroids with hydrofracking in Marcellus.
So back to the depopulation plan. When you know, when you talk to anybody outside the West Virginia area, and I try to explain what West Virginia is like, because also if you haven't been to West Virginia, and being in Maine, you'd think I'd know a thing about a mountain or two. But when you're talking about West Virginia, the mountains are literally what it reminded me of was the craters that make an egg carton. When you flip an egg carton over, there's the crater bulge to hold the egg right next to another one, right next to another one, right next to another one. And if you had to go drive a little teeny tiny car from one to the other, you literally would be going all the way down and then into a little hollow and then all the way back up and then all the way down again. I mean, the texture of West Virginia is remarkable in these steep sides to these mountains and these deep hollows in between. And so when you talk about that, and then you talk about depopulating that area, it all sounds like conspiracy theory, crazy, oh, nobody's going in there and taking the houses out. I mean, this is just, why would someone plan to depopulate an area? But it's exactly what they're doing.
Because they want those squatters off of their valuable mineral rights. Those squatters whose families have been there for, you know, 10 generations or 8 generations.
And that's the difference, too, is you can purchase the surface of the land, but you can't purchase the mineral rights underneath unless you've had a really savvy guy you're buying the property from who managed to secure the mineral rights underneath when he bought the property. So you can literally buy a house and not own what's underneath it.
Absolutely. Much like in those coal camps back in the Blair days, you can live in the house, but you're not even allowed to grow a garden in your window box or in your yard, because you had to buy every morsel from the company store.
And this was one of the things that made the Blair guys strike.
Sure. I mean, you know, when you consider that Andrew Mellon was the owner of U.S. Steel and also happened to be Secretary of the Treasury at the time, and you know, I don't believe that it was actually completely kosher to be manufacturing money that was replacing U.S. legal tender to be used in the towns that U.S. Steel used to mine its coal and high quality bituminous coal for steel making.
I think it is back in style, though, because President Obama has been naming people to his cabinet that certainly the fox guarding the hen house is seems to be back in style. I mean, some of these recent cabinet picks are kind of horrifying. But
it's cyclical, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately. And so that means that being vigilant has to be cyclical also. That if you were asleep for a few years, you got to wake up again now.
Exactly. Democracy is an angry beast. It must be fed.
So give us a little background. The Blair guys, they'd get injured or hurt or sick, and they couldn't work anymore, and the company store guy would go to the wife and say, look, you either got to leave now, take your babies and starve, or you can do a little something for me on the side, and I'll keep giving you onions, maybe a potato from time to time.
Or you could cough up your 10-year-old boy and send him into the mines to work. There were some choices, but certainly there was a type of company script called ESOW, and it was greatly used as an institutionalized manner was used as you described.
So the Blair miners from Blair Mountain, they got angry and fed up.
Well, not just Blair, it was the miners from the southern coal fields. You have to realize that war raged. And I went in and did research at the War College in Carlisle. War raged in southern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, all of that area for nearly 20 years. There was, the Battle of Blair Mountain is known as the second largest uprising in the history of the United States next to the Civil War. There were tens of thousands of armed miners who also participated in the battles of Paint Creek and Cabin Creek about a decade earlier. And it raged on, Mate One Massacre, as it's called. There are many, many examples of you know, people standing up for their dignity and trying to fight back against all odds. And unfortunately, it became something where it did become an armed conflict. However, the miners, when it came to the Blair March, the miners turned back twice. They ultimately went on, and they were literally aerially bombed with weapons of mass destruction. First bombing of the civilian populace, the first time in the history of the United States military where they use aircraft for civilian crowd control and reconnoitering. These are historical firsts that occurred there. It was a singular battlefield in the United States of America and must be preserved as such. For not only labor history and every labor local in this country, but all around the world. And we have petitions out that have signatures from scholars and labor leaders from all over the world.
We're talking with Jesse Johnson. He is a several-time candidate for governor of the state of West Virginia. He is a longtime advocate trying to protect the mountains from mountaintop removal and other destruction by the coal companies. We're going to take a really quick break, Jesse. When we come back, if you'd like to call in and talk to Jesse, you're welcome to. The number is 888-520-RICK or 888-520. What is it? 7425. 520-7425. We'll be right back with more of Jesse Johnson. Come right up.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events. accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, May 9th. An eclipse of the sun will take place over a large swath of the Pacific Ocean on May 9th or 10th. Places to the east of the international dateline, such as the Hawaiian and Cook Islands, will see this eclipse in the afternoon hours today. Places to the west of the international dateline, southern Philippines, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, will find the sun in eclipse at sunrise or during the morning hours tomorrow.
A solar eclipse happens whenever the moon passes in front of the sun. The moon won't totally cover over the solar disk this time around, so it's absolutely essential to use proper eye protection throughout the whole eclipse. Come to our website for eye safety tips.
Parts of Australia, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon and Gilbert Islands will see the moon directly in front of the sun on May 10th. Unlike a total solar eclipse, the moon will be too far away to completely block out the sun's disk. So an annulus, or thin ring, of sunshine will surround the new moon silhouette during the annular stage of the eclipse.
Whereas a very small portion of the globe will witness an annular eclipse, a broad stretch of the Pacific will see a partial eclipse. During a partial eclipse, the moon only takes a bite out of the solar disk. Many Pacific islands will see the eclipse on May 9th or 10th, depending on which side of the international dateline they reside. Come to our website at earthsky.org for details. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some new above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's all we ask tomorrow. Let's save some fun tomorrow.
Leave some green on the ground. No, it's the green in their wallets that they're worried about. We are talking. This is the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in. Rick's taking a night off to celebrate his birthday. So happy birthday, Rick. I'm talking to Jess Johnson, who is a longtime activist trying to save the mountains of Appalachia in West Virginia. And he calls it ground zero. And you got to admit it, especially if you get over there and see it. Jesse, you mentioned something that I thought was pretty interesting in the last segment. You said that not only was it unique for the battle itself, but it was unique because of the bombing of civilians by the United States military. But that's actually in the Military Defense Authorization Act for now. I mean, drones flying over the United States in the future, the indefinite detention of civilians, the killing of civilians on American soil, you know, and people say, oh, that'll never happen. But you're here to say, and no one will ever remember it happens if mountaintop removal takes up Blair Mountain.
Well, that's greatly true. And you certainly know that in 2008, I traveled 16 states telling the stories of mountaintop removal and the coal culture here in West Virginia as it has been maintained for far too long. You know, we've gone from a workforce of nearly 200,000, mostly union workers, down to less than 10,000. And
and they're, and, you know, while coal production is at an all-time high. You know, these, when I talked to these places, these 16 states, you know, I kept telling them that the company town is coming to visit them soon. And I didn't enjoy being the person who brings the message, but the reality is, that I already saw the decline of labor here so much that, and I have watched and historically, have borne witness that what happens here in West Virginia ultimately, this is the beta test for a lot of commerce. You know, our very first, industrial cartel in this, in the Western Hemisphere was right here in Kanawha Valley, which was, salt mining. And, which became, you know, extremely vital, to the growth of this country. So a lot of these companies, the families that support them, the methods by which they operate and the attitudes that they bear, go, way back. And unfortunately, bad habits come along the way.
Yeah, 2 minutes left for the person listening to you who's getting a little alarmed right now and saying, wait a minute, I got to do something. What can people do? Clearly, the representation for West Virginia, whether it be Democrat or Republican, well, frankly, it sucks. So what can people do to get beyond that? Because, you know, how can people help you help us? First of all, hang on to those mountains. You know, if you still want to have water in Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, you got to stop putting all that the mountaintop into the ravine. Really important basic things. How can people help?
Well, they can help in many ways, but crucially, I would say that, you know, the worker in this country is in such dire straits. And part of that is that the workers are being decimated themselves. And what they need to do is stand up and at least try to protect their own history. And whether, you know, whether you're FBI, FBU, or whether you're, UE, or whether you're AFL-CIO, it doesn't make any difference. Your brothers in a union and the protection of workers. And this one place, people bled and died fighting for the worker and for their rights to be treated humanely. And that practice was not taking place here. It had completely been perverted to the point where it was non-recognizable, and it's beyond most people's belief, as you well know. Mm-hmm. So the thing that people can do is preserve Blair. Blair, if we cannot save Blair, then we cannot stop mountaintop removal. We cannot save any mountain anywhere. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that blood spilled on that mountain is no different than the blood that is on Gettysburg battlefield. And who would allow Gettysburg to be blown up? And what profit would be greater in doing that than the small businesses and the preservation of our history and our culture?
Mm-hmm.
There's just no comparison.
Right, and no one would argue that the commerce that travels through the town of Gettysburg and the area around is tenfold what could be made by short-term resource pillaging. Hey, Jesse, we're out of time.
And the key is it's sustainable.
Right. As it is totally sustainable. Jesse, as always, it's wonderful to chat with you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing in West Virginia. We'll be in touch, and we'll be down to see you on our People's Tour for America, which is coming up, less than a month from now. We'll be heading down to West Virginia, and we'll join the fight to save Blair Mountain and record the history there. Thanks so much for joining us on The Rick Smith Show.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you here, and please wish Rick a happy birthday for me.
We'll do that. Jesse Johnson from West Virginia. We'll be back with more of The Rick Smith Show coming up.
One of these days we're going to wake up and find a new day. One of these days we want to wake up and make a new way. One of these days.
The Rick Smith better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The people's movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is Justice for Working People Facing Foreclosure. Action this week focused on Bank of America. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling and Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bankruptor of America, because that's more of the role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is, and working to take back the city, because it's ours.
Some U.S. Airways mechanics and related workers have filed with the National Mediation Board for an election to be represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. There are 4,000 mechanics at U.S. Airways. Those workers are currently represented by the International Association of Machinists. The Teamsters will also soon file to represent more than 11,000 mechanics and related workers at American Airlines. The two airlines are merging. The Louisiana Supreme Court has found the state's funding for its school voucher program is unconstitutional. The suit was brought by the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the decision is a, quote, stinging rebuke of Governor Bobby Jindal's agenda to strip Louisiana public schools of the resources they desperately need, end quote. In a class action lawsuit against Integrity Staffing Solutions, Amazon.com warehouse workers are seeking compensation for showing the company they aren't thieves. At the end of each workday, Amazon workers must pass through a security checkpoint where they're searched for stolen goods. The workers claim that the security checkpoints take place after they've already clocked out for the day and can take as much as 25 minutes. The employees are seeking compensation for the unpaid time spent in the checkpoints. Last week, Hawaii granted new workplace protections to domestic workers, and today Oregon is on the path to do the same. Jesse Russell reports.
A bill narrowly passed Oregon's House that would grant more workplace protections to domestic workers. Some of the items in the bill include paying workers overtime for working more than 40 hours per week or 44 hours per week if they live in the home of their employer. It expands protections against sexual harassment and guarantees workers 8 hours of sleep and at least 24 hours of consecutive rest. Employers will also be required to provide 3 personal days for domestic employees after they've worked at the home for 1 year. The bill additionally prevents employers from holding a worker's passport.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed. At least we're all in it together.
Happy, Rick Smith's birthday. Is it an official holiday? Rick Smith off today? It should be. It should be. We'll make it a holiday. It's Smithmas. Rick Smithmas. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. He's taking the night off. He's having a little holiday with his family. It's his birthday, and we wish him the best. And, you know, the problem with wonderful, happy moments and then having to go and talk about something like we're about to talk about is making the segue, so let's see how I can do that. I think I'll just flat out say this past weekend we had the 43rd anniversary of a time when our nation's history was most bleak. And the courage of a whole pile of kids on Kent State campus, well, it was rewarded with gunfire. 4 young people died that day. Allison Krauss, one of them, a 19-year-old honor student. freshman honor student, and her sister, Laurel Krause, is joining us right now. Hey, Laurel, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I wanted to wish Rick Smith a happy birthday.
Ah, wonderful. Thanks, Laurel. I'm hoping he's not listening for a whole pile of reasons, but one of them is because he's having a party. But it's not the Pat LaMarche filled in for me party. Laurel, I had a wonderful time chatting with you about 50 times over the last 5 days as I struggled to write the story of your sister's, the investigation of your sister's death. We're all happy about that, finally going to the UN. But before we get there, you told me the remarkable story about how your family learned that a 19-year-old kid who mom and dad packed off to go to college, your older sister, you were 15 at the time, packed her off to go to college. Everybody's happy. Oh, sure, she's got a little bit of long hair and some of those crazy, wacky, multicolor, wide-legged pants. A little hippie. Going to go and learn a whole pile of stuff. We're going to send her to college, and her college campus is going to be the scene of her murder at the hands of the United States military. And that has to be the scariest thing I can think of for what could happen when a parent sends their kid to college. You know, it's like you think, oh, God, I hope they don't end up at a party with a bunch of bad frat boys. That's possibly your worst thought, you know, not to pick on frat boys, but, you know, that's the stereotype. And what happens is they go and they protest the invasion of Cambodia and they never come home. So if you don't mind, again, relating to me and to everyone listening, the story of how you learned that your sister was dead, I just would really appreciate that because it's very telling about the government at the time.
Well, I'll share something else just before, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I was flying all over the country going to Kent State back this year, and I spoke to someone who was 40 years old from Bulgaria, and he knew about Kent State and Jackson. To the detail, it was amazing. He now lives in the United States in the Pittsburgh area near my family home. Mm-hmm. But people outside the United States are much more aware of what happened on May 4, 1970 than Americans are allowed to know.
You mean more than Neil Young told us?
Well, Neil Young said it very clearly, but it's a song.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hold much accountability or opportunity for redress or
yeah, I guess
apology.
I was being kind of facetious, you know, because, I mean, that really is where most of us learn the history of Kent State is from the Neil Young song.
But a lot of people don't know that Four Dead in Ohio were referring to Allison and Bill and Jeff and Sandy that, you know, were shot down on their campus at noon. I can kind of go into what happened.
1224. 1224, the National Guard opened fire.
Right. Well, the truth about what happened when that happened is just becoming known now.
Mm-hmm.
We have actual evidence that's been verified. Let's cycle back to me coming home from school and getting off the school bus. I was in ninth grade, and a neighbor ran up and said, Allison's been hurt. And I ran home and called my parents. And they showed up. And we learned that the phone lines had been cut at Kent State. All the phone lines.
Hmm.
And,
now, you had two working stiffs for parents. You had a couple of parents, both of them at work. You're, for want of a better term, latchkey kid. You come home. The last thing you think you're going to do is call your parents and say, something's happened to Allison, and by the way, I don't know what it is. I just heard it from a neighbor who heard it on the radio.
Right, right. And, you know, and I couldn't hear anything because I was in school. And the news back then was impossible to come by without being very a controlled narrative of what occurred. And it's not much different now, but I think it's even worse now in some ways, but that's a whole other story. I called my mother, and she rushed home from her job, and my dad had someone drive him home, my mom entered the home and kept calling and calling and calling. We could not get through, and it was just, you know, insidious. You couldn't even get through to find out, and then we finally got through to Robinson Memorial, the hospital in Ravenna, and the person on the phone said that she was DOA.
And so it wasn't the school wasn't trying to get a hold of you. Kent State wasn't trying to get a hold of you. The Ohio National Guard wasn't trying to get a hold of you. The governor's office wasn't trying to get a hold of you. Nobody cared to tell Alison Krauss's family that she had been shot and was dead.
Kent State University, where she was going to school as an out-of-state student, has still never informed us that she was killed. They have never formally informed us, either by phone or letter or anything. And when they sent us her tuition back, they made the check out to Alison Krauss.
No.
Really? And this has been the continuing saga of Kent State. Kick them in the shins, treat them as criminals, hunt them down, attempt to bribe them, beat them in the courts, railroad every piece of justice, and write up phony reports.
Well,
history of Kent State.
To put this in perspective, and I really had to do this after I interviewed you the first time I spoke to you earlier this week, I'm like, wait a minute. J. Edgar Hoover ran the FBI.
Yeah.
J. Edgar Hoover.
It hasn't changed much since then, by the way.
But if you want to believe the best about your government today, but we still want to get to the bottom of Kent State 40 years ago, J. Edgar Hoover, who we now all know, nobody doubts, was completely inappropriate, if not breaking the law, in the way he was surveilling private citizens, to include Martin Luther King Jr. and so many others. And I have a 4-inch thick volume at home of the transcripts of the Martin Luther King tapes. Nobody's kidding anybody anymore about the J. Edgar Hoover stuff and the things that he pulled. And why anyone would...
Well, he was
would...
also guided by the Huston Plan. And the Huston Plan was actually made much more accurate and refined during the whole incident related to Kent State. And that has now resurfaced as the blueprint for the USA Patriot Act.
Mm.
That's how deep this gets.
Yeah. So, and I actually looked up a bunch of documents and the public letter J. Edgar Hoover wrote to the people of the United States, saying that kids basically, he didn't name Allison or the other three, but kids basically, like the kids at Kent State, were the problem with the country, and they needed to be controlled. And you either were going to be a good doobie or a bad doobie. And if you're going to college.
And they were communists.
Yeah. And bums and tramps and impugning the integrity and the morality and the ethics of the young people that were protesting the war.
They had a phrase for it. They were the new left.
And a few days later, the Jackson State killings, which nobody ever talked about because those kids were black.
Right. Well, see, Kent State and Jackson State share the unusual but actually very common use of reason for gunfire by military, and that is they're responding to the sound of sniper fire. Both Jackson State and Kent State have that going on, and we feel that's the part that was actually added by the U.S. government and then never reported about, except to say that they fired because of the sniper fire.
Now,
it's a complicated story.
At the time that the story broke out, they had grabbed who they said was a sniper.
Well,
right?
No, actually, he ran into their arms and handed over the gun. And there's lots of photographic evidence of him. I have a picture right here where he's handing it over into the cop. And the cop, I've seen the video of it. It's been scrubbed from the Internet recently. But the video that I've seen shows the cop accepting it and then putting it in his pocket and kind of walking away, kind of, you know, just it's casual.
And now that gun has been lost, too. It is no longer in evidence, the handgun.
It was lost for a while, and it was retooled, and now it's been refound.
And there was a big ceremony because there's now the May 4, 1970 center, yeah. million-dollar-plus center at Kent State. And Oliver Stone spoke there this weekend at the
It was amazing.
And he talked about the sniper. Like, oh, my God, there was a sniper. And so these people...
He basically said that, you know, in summing up, he said, well, considering all the other events that have happened in our world... I believe a sniper happened. It's not that far-fetched. It's absolutely not far-fetched that a sniper would have provoked the gunfire, especially when the Ohio National Guard generals were pointing to the reason why they fired was sniper fire.
Did anyone ever tell you why the guardsmen had their live ammunition in their guns?
Now, yes, it was legal in two states.
But that still means that somebody said to a bunch of National Guardsmen, we're going to send you, and nobody knows why they were sent to Ohio State. It's just a protest. I mean, do you really expect the National Guard to show up every time a bunch of kids go out there and wave
really
a bunch of peace flags?
The Ohio National Guard were federalized when they arrived at Kent State. They had just come off of a Wildcat Teamster strike. They were federalized. They were reporting to the federal government. They didn't want to send them home because that would have taken them out of being federalized. So they send them in to Kent State. And when they were at the Wildcat strike, Teamsters actually fired at the Ohio National Guardsmen, and they did not return fire.
So there's Guardsmen, 28 members of the National Guard, just 28 guys. So, you know, for people who are trying to picture this huge force, it was 28 guys. They're standing more than a football field away from the strikers. So your sister was 343 feet away from whoever
from
shot her.
From the protesters, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and some of them were actually just students that were going across with their books, you know, changing classes.
Two of the kids who were killed, right, were actually just innocent bystanders, although all these kids were innocent. But people not participating in the protest. And so, but these guardsmen are told, put live rounds in your gun because you might have to kill students?
Yes.
Honestly, I'm always amazed.
And they had to get ready for the sniper signal.
Right. But I am always amazed by stuff that doesn't make sense to me when I finally realize it doesn't make sense. I mean, I'm too old to be continually shocked by what I don't know.
Well, here's the deal. When they were announcing the Cambodian invasion of 1970, April 30th, they had actually been bombing for a full year before the announcement. But when they were planning that announcement, they also planned the stateside domestic military battles. And those were two. Kent State and Jackson State, because they knew that the students would be upset about this. They knew there would be protests, and this was their solution.
Now, an awful lot of people, and, you know, one of the books I've read that I find incredibly fascinating, not to change the subject too much, but just to make the point, is The New 9/11, which is written about the September 11th happenings. But the author says, no one doubts a conspiracy. Everybody believes Osama bin Laden conspired to blow up the World Trade Center. So everybody agrees it was a conspiracy. The only thing we're arguing about is who the conspirators were. So pulling that back to this day is nobody in their right mind in the United States of America who's a tax-paying, voting, law-abiding citizen wants to believe that it's possible that their government conspires against the people. For some reason, believing that is so repulsive to people that when they hear these stories and realize that, oh, my God, a bunch of soldiers who didn't need to be there in the first place and certainly didn't need live rounds in their weapons were told to load their guns, they might have to kill a bunch of students, their head goes on tilt. How do we get beyond that? How do we say to people, it's okay that you're so horrified by this thought, but that didn't change whether or not it happened?
Well, I think we have to use different words. I would say it's collusion. Mm-hmm. Collusion, not conspiracy. I think that the government is colluding with all the different entities and of the government, and they are the armed forces against citizens now. And this is proven to us every day of our lives. I think that this collusion, this government collusion, it's kind of like monopoly with corporations, you know?
Mm-hmm.
but the collusion between the organizations is illegal. They're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to plan a battle like this with all the different groups. And there were a lot of groups on Blanket Hill on May 4th, 1970. There were the State Patrol, the Ohio National Guard, the Kent Police, the Kent Campus Police, the Army Intelligence, the CIA, the FBI, COINTELPRO, and groups I'll never know about.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all playing a turf war that day, too, between themselves. The whole thing, you know, people have technically recalled it a cluster F, if
mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. And ever since they've done it, they've attempted to cover it up and suppress what really happened. We're not allowed to know the truth of Kent State.
So what would happen? What would happen in the Krause household? Your dad has passed, sadly, without having justice for his daughter, but your mom, Doris, is still with us.
Yes.
What would happen in the Krause household if, you know, President Obama threw his hands up in the air and said, you know what? The jig's up. It happened in Ohio. It was wrong. It shouldn't have happened. We need to better safeguard our First Amendment rights so that people can protest, people can voice outrage. It doesn't stop the government from happening.
I think we need to start a commission on protest and peaceful activity in America. I think we need to start sponsoring, you know, inquiries into how we can have First Amendment rights again, because there's no presence of them now. And maybe he needs to call a presidential commission for that.
I think that's a great idea.
I'd like
idea.
To be part of it.
Yeah, what a fabulous idea. Now, you can't get to him to get that idea out there, huh?
Well, you know, I write to him all the time, and it's time to start doing petitions, because we have this good news from the United Nations, you know?
Yeah, let's get to that, because we're actually ticking away time faster than I could talk to you all night. just recently, April, the United Nations announced that they would be hearing evidence about whether or not there was collusion, your word, collusion, whether or not the FBI or the Department of Defense willfully killed some kids in Ohio that were protesting the actions of their government. And tell us about that.
Well, actually, in February, we submitted questions for the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations. And every 5 years, participating countries in the United Nations have to go before the Human Rights Committee, the High Commissioner. And they basically get a group of questions, and they throw them into pots, and they see where there's a whole bunch of questions. And some of the questions that came up repeatedly for the United States had to do with police brutality as well as excessive use of force. And that's certainly present at Kent State. But we sent our submission to ask about opening up a new investigation into Kent State, for what reasons the United States has not done that or chosen not to. New evidence showed up in 2010. Four people died. Basically the people that died were protesters, so it was the state possibly killing protesters, which is even a bigger sin, or it's a crime against man.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're asking them to, about, for what reason did they not open a new investigation into Kent State, as the statute of limitations for murder never lapses? And with the new Kent State's Drewby tape, uncovering the order to fire, and 70 seconds before that order to fire, four low-caliber pistol shots fired by an FBI provocateur. At least that's the picture that we've been able to uncover from the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We want to know for what reason the United States government is choosing to not investigate the new evidence.
70 seconds seems like a long time. If I'm going to hear gunshots and react... Now, I fired a weapon, but, you know, no one's been shooting at me at the time. But doesn't that seem like a long time to in between?
Well, they
the
were
reaction?
Marching up the hill away from the students. And upon hearing the order, they turned, set, and fired.
So
now,
they were ordered to fire their weapons, and they had to turn and to do it. So
they were going up the hill away from the students, and so then they had to turn. As they were going up that hill, they were all looking back to the parking lot where the students were to make sure that they could get the good aim.
We're speaking with Laurel Krauss. Her sister, Allison Krauss, was killed at Kent State 43 years ago this past Saturday. Laurel, the last guest, I had the same question. UN is going to be hearing this. Is there anything that a person who is concerned with getting the truth out of Kent State, is there anything that they can do to help you in your cause?
Yes, I'm desperately looking for someone to help us write our petition to the United Nations. I want it to be online. I got to find out who is the best online people, and I want to work with them personally. I just don't want to do it with a machine.
So it's the
anyone
Kent State
that wants to help
Truth
us
Tribunal?
With our petition. What?
They contact the Kent State Truth Tribunal?
Right. They can contact www.truthtribunal.org. And my email is laurelkrause@gmail.com.
So they can just write laurelkrause @gmail.com.
Right, and we're looking for a petition. We want the greatest petition ever so that it makes it happen and everyone can sign up and demand that the United Nations ask these important questions of the United States.
So they're going to be hearing it regardless. You want to help frame the questions that they ask?
Well, basically, they are not hearing it regardless. We are starting to participate as early as May 30th.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be doing a consult with members from the United States government agencies, and we're going to be starting to have our conversation. It's called a consultation.
Mm-hmm.
I am absolutely, you know, so excited about this United Nations opportunity that we can actually get started this month. And in October 2013, the formal review will begin with the United States answering questions of the United Nations Human Rights Committee.
And so that formal hearing is what these questions need to be submitted to?
The questions have already been submitted.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that they will be asked personally by the High Commissioner of the United States in October.
Do you know what the other questions are, what other topics are before them?
Actually, people can go and look at this. If you go to Kent State and the United Nations, I think you're going to come to some of the articles. Certainly the one that we have at, you can go to michaelmoore.com, and also Huffington Post, it's listed in the article that you wrote, right?
Yeah, it is, actually.
Okay, I'm really embarrassed.
No, I know, I am too, but I mean, it's like, oh my God, that story was, it was a labor of love because I love the dedication with which you fight for justice for your sister.
Well, this is for all of us. I mean, a lot of people come up to me and they say, oh, so sorry for your loss and how terrible. And, you know, 43 years later, I've come to terms and I feel pretty good. I've been doing a lot of good post-traumatic stress therapy. I'm a healthy person at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But this loss was for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the protesters dying, you know, in America and getting shot down by the state and getting away with it.
Yeah.
You know, everyone felt that when, if they were, you know, living and breathing and cared about life and humanity, they were aware of the fact that protesters were killed and it was done by the state on purpose.
Mm. And certainly watching the Occupy Oakland when they beat the living daylights out of that Iraq war vet. I mean, it's not beyond the pale that protesters will face at least harassment by police brutality in the future.
And they're using the same sniper excuse already in the FOIA papers that have been uncovered by Jason Leopold about Occupy. So the sniper was at Kent State. The sniper was at Jackson State. Now they're getting ready to do it with Occupy protesters in 2013.
Mm.
It's close, and we call for no more Kent State. But I'm hopeful that Americans can wake up and demand this before it happens.
Mm-hmm. Laurel, thank you. Believe it or not, it's been a half hour discussing this.
We did good. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, I'm so grateful. And obviously we're going to stay in touch with you and follow up on all this. But best of luck with your attempt. And if you can help Laurel, if you can help her with that petition, again, truthtribunal.org or laurelkrauss@gmail.com.
And I'm sending everyone peaceful wishes. Let's find some justice here.
Okay, great. That's Laurel Krauss. This is the Rick Smith Show, and we'll be right back coming up.
Seven crosses, hanging in the cold ash yard. 97 families, who lost 97 farms.
PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Amy Meyer was curious. Then she was appalled. Then she was charged with the crime of using a cell phone to video what appalled her. Welcome to the brave new world of ag-gag laws being pushed by agribusiness corporations to stop reporters, workers, animal rights advocates, and even curious 25-year-old truth seekers like Miss Meyer from recording abuses that are routinely taking place on farm animal confinement factories. Actually, these are the repressive laws of the cowardly new world of industrial ag biz, eager to keep its customers in the dark about what they're doing to the pigs, cows, chickens, etc. under their care. A resident of Utah, which passed its gag law last year, Meyer heard about some ugly doings at the Smith & Sons meat packing outfit in the town of Draper City, so she decided to take a look. Even from the public roadway where she stood, the horror was easy to see, and she dared to document it with her camera. The corporate manager scrambled out to declare that she was trespassing, later claiming that she had crossed a barbed wire fence onto corporate property. Cops were called. No such trespass was found, and she was released. But the corporation, whose owner just happens to be mayor of Draper, got city prosecutors to charge her with, ready? Agricultural operation interference, punishable by a 6-month jail term. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, thanks to a web alert by Will Potter, author of a blog named GreenIsTheNewRed.com, global public outrage poured into Draper City, and in just 24 hours, prosecutors dropped all charges against Meyer, the first person in America to be charged under these ridiculous laws. Thanks to stand-up rebels like Amy, Will, and thousands of freedom defenders, AgBiz is choking on its own ag-gag scam. To help fight it, go to change.org/aggag.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
If you look at when it came to the Wall Street bailouts, did the President of the United States listen to you when it came to bailing out the big banks?
Every sperm is sacred.
Every sperm is good.
Every soul is sacred.
Take your knife, Aaron.
Oh, every sperm is sacred, Mark Sanford. Why in the world you took them out of your neighborhood and brought them all the way to Argentina? That's the question. Special election in South Carolina. If you'll bear with me, I just want to read a quick email. Dearest, you are glorious, and I hope you really understand that. You do not need a therapist to help you figure your place in the world. You are special and unique and fabulous in a whole host of ways that are worth much longer conversation to be continued. I'm getting a hairball reading this thing. Have been having a few email problems as I am getting email through an air card at the farm. Yeah, because my wife's home, you know, with the four kids, and they don't know that I'm doing the chick from Argentina. Oh, wait, I'm editorializing a little. Where access to computer world is more than tough. Please let me know if you've gotten my last two emails, spelt wrong, so I know it is working in getting to your part of the world. Another glorious day outside. I hope you're doing well. I'm anxious to hear about your week. know that I miss you. I'm the governor of South Carolina, for God's sake. Anyway, unbelievably hard, no surprise there, to imagine it has been a week. Please also send your mailing address, as I want to send you something insignificant, meaning himself, got on a plane. Honey, I'm here, and I'm getting more insignificant all the time. Want to write an in-depth note with some thoughts on our visit when I know you were getting these emails. Hugs and much love, M. Does he not know that there's a subject that belongs at the beginning of his sentences? It's just his sentence structure alone is irritating to me. Not deserving of a governor, now U.S. congressman. But all that aside, he's the chief executive of state who lies to his special guys who babysit him or guard him or whatever your security detail does. Tells him he's hiking the Appalachians when he's actually hightailed it down to Argentina to see his girlfriend, who, by the way, is gorgeous. And he's not a bad-looking guy, but come on, she was way too good for him. And he heads down there and gets his cover, pardon the verb, blown, and has to, you know, all of a sudden grovel to his wife, who, by the way, isn't buying it and cleans him out, and lives to fight another day? How amazing. That stuff is just amazing. And, by the way, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith, and he's having a birthday party, hopefully with the radio off. But joining me right now is Greg Jacoy from South Carolina, a blog radio host in South Carolina, an active member of a third party down there, a party that's near and dear to my heart, the Green Party. And they had a candidate in this election cycle, but for some reason, the two mainstream candidates were the only people anyone talked about. Is it a race to the bottom now, just looking for candidates in South Carolina or maybe in the whole country, Greg?
Well, you know, the South Carolina Republican Party had an opportunity to choose someone other than Mark Sanford, and they failed their constituents terribly in that, because they wound up sending back to the Congress, because he was a congressman before he was a senator. Okay, what's going on here? Okay. Sorry.
That's right.
We're sending back to Congress a congressman who failed us tremendously. But I do want you to understand one thing.
What's
he
that?
Is not having sex with that woman, because he is a God-fearing Christian, and we all know and understand that God-fearing Christians do not have sex outside of marriage. So we also know that Senator Tim Scott, who he is replacing in the House of Representatives because he was appointed to the United States Senate, we know he is a virgin because he is unmarried, as is Lindsey Graham. So we know that Lindsey Graham is a virgin as well. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Wow. You know, all I know is that, who's that guy?
I'm sorry, you wanted me to talk about Eugene.
No, wait a minute.
Went in my direction.
No, wait a minute. But who's that? It's not Stephen Colbert. Who's the other guy from the Jon Stewart show who got the spinoff movies? Not Stephen Colbert, the other one.
Oh, Steve Carell.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
The 40-year-old virgin was actually just the elected officials of the state of South Carolina.
Precisely, or better than 40. Yes, that's right. That's right.
The 60-year-old virgin.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, it's entirely possible. I don't know. I know nothing about their sex lives, but we do know about Congressman Sanford's sex life, because he put it out there for all of us to know, including his children. Do you understand that when he went to celebrate his victory in the primary, his paramour showed up on the stage? This is the first time his children had seen her. Understand, she is, as you pointed out, a beautiful woman, and these are all boys.
Mm-hmm.
So this is proof positive that money trumps everything, and I know that there are people in the Republican Party and in the Tea Party who are ashamed of what has happened there.
Not enough of them, obviously. But Greg, wait a minute.
It's just like every other political party. They're not in control. The rank and file are not in control. The money people make all the decisions, and they decided that Mark Sanford was their best chance to make sure that the legislation they wanted passed got passed.
Well, let me just throw out there that our party, the Green Party, I was the Green Party's vice presidential candidate in 2004.
Thank you so much.
I'll come clean on that one right now. Our party doesn't have anybody with money. So rank and file or otherwise, there's no money. So that's a problem right to begin with. But you mean of the two major parties, it's the the same money owns both of them, and all you have to do is look at campaign contributions and see that they come from everybody in almost equal amounts to both candidates running. That may not have happened this time, though, because the Democratic challenger now. This wasn't a fait accompli. He didn't have to win. As you said, the Republicans could have put up a toaster oven, and I would have voted for him if I had been a registered Republican, you know, over Mark Sanford.
Well, and they had state legislators, people with years of experience in the state legislature running for the congressional seat.
But they don't have proportional representation. Nobody does in the country except for a couple like Portland, Maine, where they actually is instant runoff voting and you can do ranked choice voting, and eventually someone with a majority of support gets it. They had, like, 1,112 candidates running in that primary, and therefore the only one that everybody checked off enough to get a plurality of the votes was Mark Sanford.
So, there were 16 people, I think, in the primary. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so
the Democratic Party had a primary as well. There were three people in that race, and they more or less shoved one of the guys out of the picture, and it wound up being Elizabeth Colbert Bush and a perennial candidate who has never won elective office.
So Elizabeth Colbert Bush, who everybody's done, you know, they're beating themselves senseless to beat her up. What was so bad about her?
Well, she did say that she was proud of the fact that the state of South Carolina was the right-to-work state, and that did upset some people.
Everybody, hopefully, in the Democratic Party.
No,
she was
not at all.
No, I know.
She also did make a point of making sure that her buses had big banners on them. First of all, that she had buses. Once again, compare that to the Green Party, where we're lucky if we can rent a van to carry folks around. It had a big sign on the side of it that said, Elizabeth Colbert Bush means business. Okay. So Elizabeth Colbert Bush doesn't mean workers' rights. Elizabeth Colbert Bush does not mean justice. Elizabeth Colbert Bush does not even mean jobs. It means business. So
is this that old-fashioned Democratic argument, though? Is this that old-fashioned Democratic argument, though, that, oh, we got to sound like them so that we can get steal votes from Republicans who don't know we're not a Republican?
How's that been working out for you?
I know. That's what I keep saying. Can you imagine if baseball only had two teams?
If the teams that existed never changed their strategy, and this is what
Democratic
and Republican parties wait for the pendulum to swing back one way and the other, and they're always on the right. And occasionally, guess what? The pendulum swings to the left, and neither one of them is ever prepared to take control of it when that happens. So we wind up with crises like Kent State University and the Vietnam War and the economic collapse.
But that's my point. If you only have two teams. If you don't have however many teams,
absolutely,
the two teams have to fight to look alike. The uniforms would become alike. The pitchers would pitch alike. The batters would bat alike. They'd
try
as hard as they could to be more like each other because they want to be like the other guys so that they can trick somebody into rooting for them.
And those of us who love actual baseball understand how terrible that would be for baseball.
Absolutely.
So why is it good for our democracy?
It's not. Okay,
it's clearly
so the last real nail in this chick's coffin was that she didn't debate. Now, as a debater, I can't even imagine that, because debating is more fun than anything else I've ever done. My eye teeth drip when I get a chance to take on somebody stupid. You know? They do.
And that was exactly the perfect way to put it, because Mark Sanford is a stupid man. I've met him face to face. And he's astonishing. Here's the thing that I think of, Pat. The Democratic Party leadership either has no common sense, as I see it, they're either involved in a conspiracy or they're completely incompetent. It's got to be one or the other.
Occam's razor. The easiest answer is always the right one.
Probably, yeah.
They're just stupid.
I imagine you're right.
Yeah, or correct.
In my opinion, all the Democratic Party had to do if they wanted to have a serious chance to win this one-time special election, because let's all be serious, when the next general election happened, the Democratic candidate, if they won, was going to be gone again anyway. So we're looking at a temporary victory at best. But if that were going to happen, the way to make that happen is get Eugene Platt, the Green Party candidate, in those debates so he can look at Governor Sanford straight in the eye and say, I was married to my beloved wife who died of cancer years ago for 40 years and never strayed, and I cannot believe that you have the balls to stand on a stage and tell the voters of the 1st Congressional District that you want to go back to Congress when you clearly have not reformed your ways. Now, there's no way that Colbert Bush could have done that.
Right.
But by leaving Platt out of the picture, it made that conversation impossible. How could that conversation have not benefited the Democratic Party nominee?
Well, it's that sort of fear of actually having somebody with hubris, and, well, hubris is the wrong word, courage, on stage. When I was running for vice president in 2004, I could call George Bush a fascist, because, quite frankly, he was one.
Exactly.
You know, John Kerry couldn't.
Yep.
And when George Bush called John Kerry a coward, if John Kerry wanted to act like what he was being called, fine. I could have stood there and said, you used dental records to prove that you were hiding in the Alabama National Guard. They used dental records to identify the guys that came home with him. How dare you? How dare you call him a coward? You know,
yep.
But that's the thing is there's such fear that they'll be eroded from underneath that they haven't noticed the tsunami that is hitting them in the face. And again, that is the Democratic leadership and, for that matter, the Republican leadership that has failed the rank and file. Nice people who want their country to operate in a nice fashion.
Absolutely. I believe that most rank-and-file Democrats, most rank-and-file Republicans want the same kinds of things that most rank-and-file Greens want.
So,
we're all part of the 99%. It doesn't matter, as George Carlin said, it doesn't matter whether you're white-collar, blue-collar, pink-collar. It doesn't matter what color your collar is. It doesn't matter which political party you belong to. Everyone wants clean air. Everyone wants safe food. Everyone wants good jobs. Everyone wants their kids to be educated. Everyone wants to be housed. Everyone wants health care.
So it's whether or not everybody wants that for everybody else that's really the question.
Oh, yeah, that's so true.
But
everyone wants that stuff for themselves. You're exactly right.
Now, Mark Sanford.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. He's maybe the poster child for infidelity.
Oh,
not necessarily,
maybe.
But maybe. Well, he's got some competition. I mean, John Edwards gave him a run for it and some other people.
Oh, yes, no question about that. And even saintly Al Gore apparently has questionable behavior from time to time.
Really? He's kind of hot. Oh, anyway. So, and every now and then he sounds a little bit green. So we've got the poster child for infidelity. What are the chances that my fantasy of the week, and Lord knows it has stiff competition, my fantasy of the week is that he becomes unfaithful to his party. He goes to Congress and he says, you know what? I think I'm going to invite the labor unions to come in and talk to me. I think I'm going to have a little bit of discussion about actually giving a fair shake to the average person. What's the chance that Mr. Infidelity can prove that he's unfaithful to the people who gave him all the money to make sure he won this election and just shock all of us?
I'm sorry. I don't have any idea how to respond to that.
That's why it's called fantasy.
There you go. I don't know. It's obviously the real one of my friends who also has a podcast made the point. He said, okay, this man has been elected. Now it is our job as his constituents to make sure he does what we want him to do. And I thought to myself, isn't that sweet that he still believes in Santa Claus?
Yeah.
That just
isn't happening to anybody. Again, the Washington Post said 20% approval rate for Congress. And by the way, that's gone up. 20% approval rate for Congress, but 90% reelected.
Yeah.
People just aren't communicating, and I think keeping us in poverty is part of the plan. You know, when you work in three part-time jobs, it's awful hard to get a hold of your congressman.
We had a gentleman on our show earlier today who has had 4 heart attacks, 7 strokes, lost a foot to diabetes, and later I was speaking with the Green Party candidate for United States Senate about 8 years ago, Efia Wangaza, and she said that she believes that all these things are designed to keep working people in a constant state of crisis so that we cannot organize and we stay pitted against one another day in and day out.
And those words like organized have become dirty words. And that's the other battle we face. And this is a discussion that Rick Smith, by the way, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for him. That's the other thing Rick Smith and I have talked about off air is how do we convince people and help people understand that your workplace being organized is a good thing? That when people talk to you about working together, that as Jesse Johnson said when he was on earlier in the show tonight, that whether you're a member of a coal mining union or a member of any other union in this country, we all have to work together to save Blair Mountain because it's the history of the labor movement. That you know, we're going on this trip around the country, the People's Tour for America, and we're going to write the history of the labor movement, and that's going to be a book that'll be coming out this year. That all of these things are important, and we need to take whatever taint they've put on the idea of working together, either in our workplace or in our political world or in our churches or wherever it is, working together to better everything for our community, our neighborhood, our fellow U.S. citizen and our fellow occupant on the planet. How do we get people to stop thinking about that as dirty words?
Well, as AA said, everyone needs to understand that capital has its own union. It's called the Chamber of Commerce. And if it's okay for capital through the Chamber of Commerce to organize collectively for change, why is it unacceptable for those of us who are working people to organize ourselves to make change? We're simply picking up the gauntlet that they've thrown down by organizing themselves against us.
Yeah, and an awful lot of people in the Chamber of Commerce are everyday good people, too.
Oh, absolutely. I'm talking about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, these big national organizations. I'm certainly not talking about I'm a neighborhood small business owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm certainly not talking about that. Don't get me wrong. There are neighborhood small business owners who are jerks who do bad things and pollute the environment, et cetera. But the scale is so different.
That is the thing that we run into, though, and that's the problem with language. And language is really what's killing us right now is when we talk about corporate America attacking us, 87% of corporations are owned by families. So we offend 87% of the people with the word corporation when what we mean is multinational corporation, power retailers, fast food joints, these economic behemoths, these nightmares. And so our language is robbed from us because, of course, we don't mean the guy that incorporated. So if his business goes bad, he doesn't lose the car.
Right.
You know.
Well, I hate to use the. I can't. I just forgot what I was going to say.
Hated it. You hated it so bad you drove it from your own mind.
So, I can't remember what I was going to say. It does happen to me from time to time. You'll have to forgive me.
Absolutely. So Greg Jacoy is talking to us live right now from sunny, beautiful South Carolina. What's the next step? And actually, I was in Charleston, South Carolina about 2.5 months ago.
That's right, with Diane.
Yeah, with Diane Nylon. And you folks have probably the most innovative, one of the most innovative homeless shelters and homeless advocacy programs going on in South Carolina and Charleston, where you had a social worker who was so frustrated by what was happening to the people that he was advocating for, the homeless that he was advocating for, almost exclusively United States veterans, that he went to law school.
Wow.
And when he finished law school, he went right back to the shelter. He practices law from the table, from the conference table in the shelter. He doesn't have a single client that isn't a homeless person. I mean, this is a great American hero. I wrote about him on the Huffington Post. People can go read about him. He's an amazing guy. He's right there in Charleston, South Carolina. How could the same state that got us him re-elect or elect Mark Sanford to anything?
Well, all right. We're back to the question of the Democratic Party leadership and their inability to see outside the box. Knowing what I know about the state of South Carolina, I can tell you that one of the phrases that you can use with regularity to get a reaction out of people is Hollywood liberal. So what do? You run a New York a New York actor liberal's sister as a candidate, and you don't expect to offend anybody in the process. If the Democratic Party had nominated this fellow that you were speaking about and put the backing behind him and made an opportunity for youth and the black community in the 1st Congressional District to connect with that campaign, tell me that the Democratic Party would not be much better off after that election had been run, whether he was elected or not. Now, in addition, you've got Ken Riley, who is the former president of the International Longshoremen's Association, based right there in Charleston, and he is a hero of the labor movement in the United States because of the strikes that he has led at the fort in Charleston. You've got the mayor of Charleston itself, who has been elected and reelected. I think he's a jerk, but he's been elected and reelected for 30 years. He's a Democrat. Instead, they turn to Elizabeth Colbert Bush. Nothing against her. I don't think she did anything wrong. But the Democratic Party leadership failed the Democratic Party rank and file by nominating her when they had other choices, like this gentleman. I mean, who is not, once, even if you leave Eugene out of the conversation and leave him out of the debates, that's the kind of guy who probably does have the gumption to look at Sanford in the face and say, really, you're really going to run? You're not ashamed of yourself enough for your ethics violations, the fines that you've paid, all these other accusations have been laid on your table and proven to be the truth. You're willing to be here and campaign for this office? I cannot believe the big brass ones you've got flying between your legs.
And there's but they do believe about it. They know all about him in Argentina.
Yes, ma'am, they apparently do.
They look just like that bull on Wall Street.
And as full of bull, that's right.
Okay, and real quickly,
yes, ma'am.
This fella in South Carolina, I'm searching frantically for his name right now, I'll say it in the next half hour, but this fella in South Carolina, last year alone, he advocates for veterans to get their benefits. Last year alone, 2012, 19,550 United States veterans died waiting for their benefits. 19,550, $437 million were paid to survivors of these dead 19,000 people, veterans, who we let die waiting for their benefits, who may not have died. Especially one woman testified that she felt if her husband had gotten his benefits, he might not have taken his life. This is how we treat veterans, and the one man, like you said, who was fighting, who went to law school and went right back to the homeless shelter to help those homeless veterans, he's not even entertained as with the notion. And maybe he wouldn't run, but, boy, it would have been nice if they'd called him.
Well, and let me, I know that the time is very short. Let me share one last observation. We talked about how the press didn't cover the Green Party candidate. He was denied access to the debate. Now, there was only one debate, which I believe was a mistake. I believe if Colbert Bush had debated Sanford repeatedly, she'd have had a better shot at winning, whether Eugene was involved or not. But that one debate was sponsored by Patch.com, which, of course, sounds like, you know, your like nice neighborhood Patch. Of course, it's owned by AOL, a huge multinational corporation. But they not only did they leave him out of the debate, guess where the debate was held? It was held at the Citadel in Charleston, a military training school with a strict code of conduct.
Yeah.
That I feel pretty sure does not allow for their students to be having sex with or, you know, without the benefit of marriage.
Yeah. 30 seconds.
And Eugene is the only veteran in the campaign, and he is excluded from that debate. Now, you tell me that doesn't ring your chimes.
Rings my chimes. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks for joining us. This is the Rick Smith Show, and we will be back coming up.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The People's Movement to counteract the corporate agenda is growing increasingly energized and active in Chicago. Amisha Patel is with the Grassroots Collaborative, a coalition of labor and community groups in Chicago. One of the group's campaigns is Justice for Working People Facing Foreclosure. Action this week focused on Bank of America. She says the corporate agenda is behind issues like massive school closings and the foreclosure crisis, and Patel says working people have to come together as communities to fight against the damage that agenda is doing to working people.
Instead of calling them Bank of America, we prefer to call them Bankruptor of America, because that's more of a role that they're playing. In some ways, we're ground zero in some of the fight, and I think our mayor is a key part of why that's true. But I also think that we are, you know, birthplace of some serious organizing, and there has been years and years of folks working together in coalition. We're actually more ready than ever for these fights. And we're not just reacting, right, but we really are trying to put forward a progressive, proactive vision of what the city is and working to take back the city, because it's ours.
Some U.S. Airways mechanics and related workers have filed with the National Mediation Board for an election to be represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. There are 4,000 mechanics at U.S. Airways. Those workers are currently represented by the International Association of Machinists. The Teamsters will also soon file to represent more than 11,000 mechanics and related workers at American Airlines. The two airlines are merging. The Louisiana Supreme Court has found the state's funding for its school voucher program is unconstitutional. The suit was brought by the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the decision is a, quote, stinging rebuke of Governor Bobby Jindal's agenda to strip Louisiana public schools of the resources they desperately need, end quote. In a class-action lawsuit against Integrity Staffing Solutions, Amazon.com warehouse workers are seeking compensation for showing the company they aren't thieves. At the end of each workday, Amazon workers must pass through a security checkpoint where they're searched for stolen goods. The workers claim that the security checkpoints take place after they've already clocked out for the day and can take as much as 25 minutes. The employees are seeking compensation for the unpaid time spent in the checkpoints. Last week, Hawaii granted new workplace protections to domestic workers, and today Oregon is on the path to do the same. Jesse Russell reports.
A bill narrowly passed Oregon's House that would grant more workplace protections to domestic workers. Some of the items in the bill include paying workers overtime for working more than 40 hours per week or 44 hours per week if they live in the home of their employer. It expands protections against sexual harassment and guarantees workers 8 hours of sleep and at least 24 hours of consecutive rest. Employers will also be required to provide 3 personal days for domestic employees after they've worked at the home for 1 year. The bill additionally prevents employers from holding a worker's passport.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
It's the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick Smith. And, no, we're adaptive. We adapt well. Look at our fabulous opposable thumbs or whatever. You know, we can cling to the branch. Could always do that. Our tails dropped off when we realized we didn't really need them anymore. So, you know, I wonder if that guy wants creationism in the school and just evolution when it comes to talking about climate change. There's a guy from Exxon. The dude from Exxon, yeah. Exxon Mobil, you know, to me, I made a Trekkie reference to Brett and he didn't get it. And it shattered my world because the guy's such a high-tech techie, but I guess he doesn't need Star Trek. You know, the Kobayashi Maru, the no-win scenario, and, of course, it didn't apply to Captain Kirk. There's never been a no-win scenario. He will pull his fat out of the fire at the last minute. He'll go into the past. He'll get a couple of whales, bring them to the future. Everything's going to be fine. That's what's wrong. The guys who run everything think they're all Captain Kirk. And we can push ourselves to the brink of disaster and then just, you know, like pull ourselves back again because of this incredible evolutionary resourcefulness where all of a sudden we learn how to breathe CO2 or something instead of oxygen. Joining us right now, John Atkison, who has got so much street cred on the world of global climate change. And climate change is what we need to call it now, because if you hear one more person tell you on a warm January day, global warming, it's all right with me. Oh, sorry, that was my Maine accent, but that's how Mainers say it. Then you realize that we've lost the argument by talking global warming, and we need to talk climate change. Hey, John Atkison, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Rick Smith's having a birthday, so you've got me.
Oh, well, that's better. I mean, you know, he's allowed to have a birthday. If I have to have him, he has to have
him. Yeah, they get to be a punishment after a while. I guess it's better than the alternative, as they say.
I'll drink to that.
Yeah. Are you drinking already?
No.
Two drink minimum.
I'm in a different time zone. I can drink.
Two drink minimum to be on the program. Now, what is global climate change, you know, rising sea levels, drowning polar bears, melting polar ice cap? Oh, you doom and gloom people. What?
Well, you know, but at least it explains why I'm in Nebraska, right?
That's right. You're like, I keep making movie references, but you're like on the original Superman back in the day. Well, not the original, but the original movie that was made with Christopher Reeves, where the bad guy decides he's going to buy waterfront footage and all he needs to make it work is knocking California into the ocean.
Okay. Other than that, no problem.
You'll be waterfront footage in Nebraska in no time?
Well, we have, as you may have heard, we have a different set of problems here. And the nub of it here is the stinking drought that is really killing us. And it goes from the bottom, where the Platte River meets the Missouri, up to the top, which is up in the Rockies, because in the Rockies, that's where they keep our water in the form of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to melt and run down the hill and get in the Platte and all the other little rivers. And then, you know, where everybody's got water and it recharges that fabulous Ogallala aquifer. And everybody's good. But what's happening is that it's not coming as snow as much anymore, and it's coming as rain. And that just runs right away. And we don't have that reservoir on top of the mountain that sort of drips that water down to us all summer. So when there's a drought and there's no snowpack, we're in a world of hurt. And there's no way to explain the current weather patterns unless you include the factor of, pardon my expression, global warming, and that's what's causing the climate to get all wacky, and snow become rain, and rain to go away, and it's just brewing everything up royally.
So, and it's screwing it up faster than they thought it would screw it up.
You know, there's a guy, Jim Hansen, who just retired as the head of a big part of NASA, National Aeronautics Space Administration. And he wrote an op-ed piece, an editorial that was in the Washington Post, and it was in our local paper here, too, the Lincoln Journal Star, in Lincoln, frickin' Nebraska, for goodness sake. And that's what he said. He says, you know, back in the 70s and 80s when we first started, you know, doing the math on this, we made pretty good predictions about how warm it would get and so forth. But he said, we sort of missed how bad the climate effect would be from just this much warming, and it's keeping on getting warmer and warmer, and, you know, so they did miss that, and he really apologized for that, but you know what, I would say to Jim Hansen, says, well, you know, we've never really screwed up a whole planet this way before, you know, give yourself a break.
You don't have a model.
Now,
the story came out just a few months ago after Sandy that actually Superstorm Sandy was predicted by NASA 6 years ago. They predicted almost to the day when it would fall. They predicted the location that Sandy would ravage. That, you know, these big climate models, while they couldn't predict from the 70s to the 12s and the 13s, they are able to predict relatively accurately in the space of a half a decade, you know, catastrophic storms. And oh, by the way, they're not stopping those predictions. They're predicting more of them.
Well, and it's really, I mean, there's a lot of really complicated, non-intuitive stuff. But there's one part of the global warming effects equation that is actually pretty direct, and that is hurricanes, tropical storms, get their energy directly from the heat at the surface of the ocean. And when you make that stuff hotter, the storm gets stronger. It's a linear progression. I had an email exchange with Dr. Kayla Emanuel, who's a top climate hurricane guy from MIT. And, you know, I said, okay, there's a direct relationship. So when does that curve stop to drop off? The water gets warmer. At some point, the wind speed, that's a direct relationship with that. Sometimes that's got to stop. And he says, no, it doesn't stop. The hotter it gets, the stronger the wind blows, period. And there's no curve. It just keeps on going. And
so there could be a Category 6 hurricane someday? 5 is the biggest we've had.
Well, and really that's just a sort of a fiction, because the bottom of the 5, the top of the 4, that line,
mm-hmm.
that's just a convenience. There is no top of the 5. There is no, there's no more 5, it's a 6. It's just a, and there's been a fair amount of discussion on, do we have a situation where we need to redefine the scale? And one of the things that Dr. Emanuel and others have done is to create what they call a storm strength index that takes into account, you know, the size of the storm, the wind, top wind speed, which is what we really look at now, and other factors that really give you an index of the whole strength of the storm. And that really is very informative, because what you see is that in aggregate, you mush all the storms together, you add them up, so to speak, hurricane season have been more and more and more powerful as the sea surface temperatures have been getting warmer and warmer and warmer.
Now, let's talk a little bit about John Atkinson for a minute, just to give people a little background. You started out in Delaware working on this on these issues, and then because of your work, you were scooped up and brought down to the New Orleans area. Now, did you go there before or after Katrina?
No, I was there a couple of years after, and one reason I went to New Orleans was because I wanted to see what it was like in the first major American city to take a direct hit that could be directly attributed to some degree to global warming. And boy, did I get an eyeful.
Mm. I was down there within a few days of the hurricane. I got as far as Baton Rouge. I was down there reporting for the for a newspaper, and I was broadcasting on about 6 New England radio stations. And I was there about 3 weeks before they let us go down into New Orleans, the city. And everything had a water mark. Everything had a water level mark, including this one man who was walking the streets trying to help people who refused to leave. His clothing had water marks on them because he had waded through so much of this water. Absolute devastation. I was there visiting you years later, and the marks on the houses saying who was in there dead and other information were still on the houses. We were in the Ninth Ward. This doesn't seem to have, while it was devastation to a level that, you know, you and I could take a long time trying to describe, it doesn't seem to have been anything that people have taken to heart for very long.
Well, it's a story of yet another one of those gaps that word gaps has really stuck in my head, because there's a huge gap, for instance, on the gun control. You know, 90% of the people in the United States really wanted to change the policy on background checks and didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge gap between what the people want and need and what they get from the system, what the system can deliver. And it's the same is true in two different ways about experiences like Katrina, experiences like Superstorm Sandy, where actually, if you look at the responsible polling data, people get it about global warming. They're not out in the streets because they are not clear on what they can do about it. And one reason is that even though most people get it most of the time on global warming, the political system has totally, totally refused to respond appropriately. And, I mean, in bits and pieces, yes, and we need all the help we can get. We'll take it. But this is, without a doubt, the most dangerous challenge that our species has ever faced. I mean, the World War II generation in the United States, we call them the greatest generation. Well, you know, it's going to be pretty interesting, I guess you could say, to see what, you know, in a couple of generations, what are they going to call us? Because it's on us to turn away or towards the very worst consequences of global warming that we got a tiny peak of in 2012.
Now, I know that when it comes to alternative energy, first of all, one of the things I learned was absolutely all energy on the planet is solar energy. It's the sun that makes the wind. So if your wind turbine's burning because it's windy, it's because the sun heated or didn't heat the winds, and the winds caused, you know, blah, blah, blah. So
the coal and the gas, they're basically distilled solar energy. I mean, they're plants and animals that died and got all squished and heated and turned into coal and oil, and that's basically reconstituted solar energy right there as well.
And then all across Facebook, you see the picture of, you know, the wildly hot sun with the sunspots and say, you know, this really can't power the Earth. We don't believe that this solar energy would power the Earth. But all that aside, I do know that at least domestically in the United States of America, the best thing we could do, more than any other way in the next 5 years we could create more energy, would be to conserve what we do make. To stop wasting energy to the degree that we waste it would have a greater impact, at least right now.
You know, it's, like I say, I think we need all the help we can get, and it's all hands on deck. Every method that's effective needs to be employed and deployed, and that's certainly one of them.
So as people do that, though, John, as people are using less coal in the United States, people are using less oil in the United States, the price of oil and gasoline being a big help on that happening, as that's happening, then we hear the quote from the dude from Exxon that, you know, we don't have to worry about it, and they go to more extreme methods to harvest these fossil fuels and export them.
Right,
so,
and that's... You know, it's like here in Nebraska, the big issue is the Keystone XL pipeline proposal, where they want to ram one of these tar sands diluted bitumen pipelines down through the very wettest part of the Great Plains Aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, and put that at risk. And it's going from Canada through the United States to be refined on the Gulf Coast at a refinery that's half owned by the Saudi Arabians and be shipped for export. Now, there's a new organization out here on the plains called the All Risk, No Reward Coalition.
Yeah. And just for people who don't know how that works, what they're doing is reversing the flow in a whole pile of very old pipelines with oil so full of sand it's effectively sandpaper. That is running backwards through pipelines, because pipelines used to go the other way so that the refinery stuff could be pumped out to people who needed it. And it's extremely dangerous to run that liquid sandpaper through these pipelines. It's just an accident waiting to happen.
Even worse, even the new pipelines, like the XL or the Keystone One or the Exxon pipeline that just burst in Arkansas, and wiped out a nice community of ranch houses. You know, all of this stuff is so corrosive, and they cut so many corners on maintenance that it's a guarantee that this stuff will spill. And it's so thick that to get it to go through the pipeline, they have to mix it with dilute it with things like benzene and other chemicals. Just to make it flow, and that makes it extremely, horrendously dangerous. just to breathe the air around the spill. It's just grotesque.
So, again, I'm asking the same question of everybody. I've had, it's like doom and gloom night. Rick Smith has a birthday. Everybody else has to cry with the stories we're talking about. But,
well, you know, let me say it this way, because I just got off from giving a little speech at a Audubon Society here, and you know, it's we have a lot of energy choices here as well as across the nation, and I said, you know, we're in a very tough spot, but the first thing we should say is that we can fix it. We know how to fix it. It's not a matter of technical needing to invent a whole bunch of new wowie stuff. We've got everything we need. All we need that we're missing is the political will to do so.
So that
is the only answer, because, you know, the business class ain't doing it. The political class ain't doing it. That leaves me and you, Pat.
And who do we contact, our representatives, and say?
Well, there's a number of organizations that have popped up across the country addressing directly the bullying of the fossil fuel companies, 350.org, which is just
350.org, fabulous organization. Yep.
Bill McKibben. They're terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a new movie out, by the way, called Do the Math,
mm-hmm.
which sort of very simply explains that there's not enough room in the atmosphere for all the crap that the fossil fuel companies want us to burn
right.
without causing a huge, huge disaster. So 350.org is one. Sometimes the Sierra Club can be effective. Sometimes it's another organization. It depends on the locality. Here I work, my day job is energy policy guy for Nebraska Wildlife Federation, which is an affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation. There's any number of...
Are we going to get Mark Sanford, though, and these representatives? I mean, he's our...
You know, this is another case of these gaps. It's just nutty. We just had a city council election here, and, you know, there was... This ho-hum stuff got elected, and the one candidate who was willing to use the word climate change... for a lot of technical reasons, didn't have a good chance, but she didn't come in dead last either. So it's a very muddled situation when you try to translate your concern into the action of, you know, through politics. And we have an excellent situation here in Nebraska. It's the only state that's 100% public power. It's all publicly owned.
Mm-hmm.
Inside Nebraska. So in most of the places in the state, people can directly elect the boards of directors, and you're seeing more and more progressive people being elected, and the folks who are just going along doing it the same old way, a lot of them are starting to wake up and saying, wait a minute, wind power is directly price competitive with coal power, and it's clean? Yeah, we ought to do some of this.
You know, we're taking off on a trip, the whole little crowd of us here from the Rick Smith Show. We're on a trip, the People's Tour for America. We leave the first week of June, and we're headed around the country and I'll be writing a book about labor history, and we'll be interviewing all kinds of cool, I know, it's really, like, fabulous. Thanks for including me, Rick.
Yeah.
Brett is really cool, the guy's on the phone when we brought you online. We're going to be doing this, and it's really exciting to think that we might be able to be on the ground all around this country talking to people about these options. But the scariest thing when you talk about, you know, jobs and work is they take something like that Keystone Pipeline. They take something like you know, look, you may not like us, but these are the only jobs we're going to give you. And they waive these jobs at a 7 to effectively 15% unemployment rate, and everybody caves in.
Well, not everybody, and this is sort of a classic organizing success here,
mm-hmm.
because not everybody's against this pipeline. Some people just want the easement money, and some people just mm-hmm. give in to the bullying. But you have a huge number of people that's an unlikely coalition. You have ranchers like our spokesman, Randy Thompson. You know, he's a rancher, wears the big hat and the whole shebang. And you have city people, and you have farmers, and you have the farmers union here is fabulous. Come to Nebraska on your tour, Pat. Mm-hmm. You will find the very lively remnants of a populist era that never died. And people are up, and they're kicking ass with their pointy little cowboy boots, let me tell you that.
Well, there's plenty of it to kick if we come to town.
You ain't kidding. I'm just agreeing with you.
John Atkinson, you're fabulous. Thanks for taking the time to join us on the Rick Smith Show.
You bet. Come to see us now, you hear?
Okay, good. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith, and this is the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Amy Meyer was curious. Then she was appalled. Then she was charged with the crime of using a cell phone to video what appalled her. Welcome to the brave new world of ag-gag laws being pushed by agribusiness corporations to stop reporters, workers, animal rights advocates, and even curious 25-year-old truth seekers like Miss Meyer from recording abuses that are routinely taking place on farm animal confinement factories. Actually, these are the repressive laws of the cowardly new world of industrial ag biz, eager to keep its customers in the dark about what they're doing to the pigs, cows, chickens, etc. under their care. A resident of Utah, which passed its gag law last year, Meyer heard about some ugly doings at the Smith & Sons meatpacking outfit in the town of Draper City, so she decided to take a look. Even from the public roadway where she stood, the horror was easy to see, and she dared to document it with her camera. The corporate manager scrambled out to declare that she was trespassing, later claiming that she had crossed a barbed wire fence onto corporate property. Cops were called. No such trespass was found, and she was released. But the corporation, whose owner just happens to be mayor of Draper, got city prosecutors to charge her with, ready? Agricultural operation interference, punishable by a 6-month jail term. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, thanks to a web alert by Will Potter, author of a blog named GreenIsTheNewRed.com, global public outrage poured into Draper City, and in just 24 hours, prosecutors dropped all charges against Meyer, the first person in America to be charged under these ridiculous laws. Thanks to stand-up rebels like Amy, Will, and thousands of freedom defenders, AgBiz is choking on its own ag-gag scam. To help fight it, go to change.org/ag-gag.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Amy Meyer was curious. Then she was appalled. Then
this is the Rick Smith Show.
And right now we're going to talk to Ellen Ratner of Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, how are you?
How are you? And I know you guys are working together and you're going to be doing a trip across country together.
I wish
I could join you. Maybe I can for a night or two.
Oh, that would be great because we are going to be all over the place. So Brett's working really hard on the schedule and where we're going to be, and maybe we can line that up, and we'll be broadcasting from the road. So if we could have you sit in on the show.
Maybe you'll be in the great state of Ohio.
We will be in the great state of Ohio, as fate would have it. All kinds of good stuff going on in Ohio. And Ohio, home of Cleveland, of course, where they actually have a locally owned energy company.
Really?
Yeah.
And you guys are going to be, well, you know, I'm from Cleveland.
Oh, are you? My son,
I'm probably the only person in the world that happened to be in Watertown, staying at my foster son's house the night they caught the alleged bomber, and was in Cleveland, Ohio, the night that they found those women.
Is that, have you got an alibi for any of this?
I know. Isn't that wacko?
Yeah, I'm starting to worry about that. We'll have to get you a public defender.
I know.
Yeah, that's great. My son went to Oberlin.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a great place to go, too.
It is. I have a very fond attachment to Cleveland for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and because it was so close to Oberlin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of the bombers, you've got all kinds of stuff to talk to us about tonight, but they're going to be, what's the latest news on the bombing suspect?
Well, on the bombing suspect, I mean, what we do know is that there is a funeral, not a funeral home, but a burial ground that did take alleged bomber number one and buried him, but nobody is saying where it is for obvious reasons, and it will probably be an unmarked grave.
They're not going to throw him in the water with Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, they definitely are not going to do that. Yeah. However, there was a hearing on the Boston bombing today, and the Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis talked. He said he was not aware that the Russian intelligence had issued a warning to the United States about him prior to April 15th. He said that today at the U.S. House Committee's Homeland Security hearing. Also, they had former Senate Chair of Homeland Security Joe Lieberman speaking, and he said that it's a time to teach the nation that the enemy is violent Islamist extremists. Well, yes, but we also know that there have been violent people who have nothing to do with Islamic terrorism.
I was going to say, what is Lieberman's comment on his home state of Connecticut and the
exactly.
Newtown Sandy Hook killer? I mean, to say we can profile by saying it's a violent Muslim extremist means we don't look at anybody else as a bad guy?
Right.
How ridiculous. I'm you know, my estimation of him keeps falling, and I thought it had gotten low enough. Mr. Lieberman. But what that does beg the question is, can we look for congressional hearings when a guy goes crazy and kills a bunch of 5-year-olds, or is it just going to be something like this?
Well, it's just going to be something like this, mm-hmm. and that shows that it is actually quite partisan.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Right. Very unfortunate. Unfortunately, we won't be finding new actions to stop tragedies of a different sort. This
right.
is the only sort of tragedy we want to try and stop, I guess.
Exactly.
Pretty upsetting. Now, you have more information on Benghazi as well.
Well, that's right. So Benghazi, as you know, there was a 6-hour hearing yesterday. They actually stopped all votes during it so that people could come in. But now there's a lot of pressure from Speaker Boehner, or to Speaker Boehner. They want him to create a select committee to investigate the Benghazi attack, and Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham, both senators, are really putting pressure on the House to do these kind of hearings, or to do this special select committee, because just like Watergate, because mm-hmm. people know that it is not going to happen in the Senate.
And that is so I don't know. Does that seem like regular protocol?
Well, it's regular protocol if you want to make sure that Hillary Clinton isn't going to be the nominee.
Yeah. And now Dick Cheney weighed in on this.
Dick Cheney weighed in on it. Yes, he was there as well.
I don't know if you know this, but I ran against Dick Cheney.
You did?
I was the 2004 vice presidential candidate for the Green Party.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have to tell you, being beaten by a man who shoots his friend in the face just hurts a girl's feelings.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I didn't realize you were the Green Party nominee. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was quite a year, I'll tell you. And then, of course, it ended up being slim pickings, too, when John Edwards' stories all shook out. So there you have it. That was quite a ticket, Dick Cheney versus John Edwards versus Pat LaMarche. Yeah. The little heard of. So Dick Cheney, does he realize he's not in power anymore, or is he still in power?
Well, I think that he believes that he's still in power with a certain part of the party. And unfortunately, you know, he hasn't done the sort of ecumenical thing that George Bush has done. George Bush has really sort of moved on from a lot of that and is focusing on doing stuff in Africa, et cetera, but Dick Cheney is not.
Yeah, I heard, though, that was part of George Bush's homework. He actually has now found Africa. And
well, you know, I wrote a really out there article, considering I'm very liberal, mm-hmm. and I go to Africa every 12 weeks. And honestly, George W. Bush has done more for Africa than anybody.
Really?
I hate to say it, because I think, you know, what I like to say is he murdered 141 people as governor of Texas. He killed 100,000 people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Maybe a lot of people have it as more. It's probably more like that right now. And he single-handedly saved 2 million people with his PEPFAR program. And a lot of people don't like to give him credit for it. And there's a lot of reasons not to like George Bush, but he did one good thing, and that was Africa.
Well, you know, my mom used to say even a broken clock's right twice a day.
Exactly.
But the other point is that if you go down through history, everybody's got their yin and their yang. And
right.
If people who are good at something could find a way to just stop there and not do the part they're bad at, you know, that would be what's really great. Unfortunately, George Bush was very good at the stuff he was bad at as well. Or the bad things that he did. One of the things that's interesting, though, I think, is wasn't he very heavily involved, too, with Bono, or at least his administration, with helping Africa?
I believe so. I believe so. For some reason, he focused on Africa, and that was a good thing.
Yeah. AIDS, too. He was very concerned about AIDS.
Well, part of the PEPFAR program is that 2 million people are getting antiretroviral.
Now, is there any investigation into, I know that he was for abstinence only in Africa training, and that was a problem.
Well, that has been part of the criticism of the program, and, you know, nobody perfect, as somebody told me when I pointed out mass graves that Saddam Hussein had done, and an Iraqi person said, well, nobody perfect. I said, oh, my gosh. So nobody perfect on this. He certainly... in terms of at least getting the medication to people, he did that.
Yeah, he is such a conundrum. You know, because people without medication in the United States, and you know, if we could get George Bush to expand those parts of his mind that understand those things, he probably would have been a good president.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, real quickly, I did hear that you go to Africa often, and your concern is the Sudan.
South Sudan, yeah.
Yeah. My son, when he was the Oberlin kid, when he was an exchange student in Egypt, would teach English to refugees from Sudan.
Oh, yeah, and they had a lot of them.
Oh, yeah,
they certainly did.
Yeah, and I actually was fortunate enough to go with him to some of these classes when I was over there visiting. And, wow, these people, they have absolutely no one left in their family.
Yes, you've seen entire families completely decimated.
Yeah. What wonderful stuff you do. I'm so glad that you're doing that.
Well, you can go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and look at what we do.
Okay, great. I'll do that. Okay, so Gitmo, speaking of absolute horror shows, the hunger strike is, they're force feeding now. There are pictures of the force feeding chairs that are being used. The only British detainee at Guantanamo speaking out now and getting a lot of publicity in Guantanamo. What's up right now at Gitmo?
Well, tomorrow, the chief, Colonel Morris Davis, he was the former chief prosecutor at Gitmo, he is going to deliver 188,999 petition signatures to close Guantanamo Bay, and he's working with a group called Witness Against Torture.
That will that have any impact?
I don't know. I mean, if you have a guy who used to be the chief prosecutor on this issue, mm-hmm. that's quite something.
Right. And costing right now $900,000 per inmate per year to
right.
keep them there.
Crazy.
Incredible. You're right. The Full Faith and Credit Act, H.R. 807?
Yes. So basically, it's not a Faith and Credit Act at all. It allows the government to borrow above the debt ceiling, but only to pay people who have U.S. bonds and Social Security, nothing else. It's absolutely going to go nowhere in the Senate, and it was passed by the House, and as Steny Hoyer called it the Pay China First Act.
And actually, our largest debt, is it Japan now, then China, then Western Europe? I mean, do we know where all this debt is that we have?
Well, we do know where it is, but yeah. Of course, some people have put it into European banks, and they may also be from China, so it's hard to know who actually has all of it.
And if we don't do this, is there a chance that people with U.S. bonds and their Social Security won't get paid?
Well, you know, I don't think they're going to get let it get to that, but one never knows with this government and with the people that we've elected to be in. I don't mean government Obama. I mean
right.
collective government.
Yeah, all together. Now, Ellen, were you surprised that they let the sequester go through?
I was, actually. I think they thought that they were going to get a budget, but today they refused to have a budget committee a meeting, actually. The Republicans have refused to go to conference on the budget, which is just crazy.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, I've gotten frustrated with Congress because they gave away their right to declare war in the last administration, and then in this administration they picked a committee to decide financial matters rather than doing it all together, which was their job. I'm just sort of curious what Congress does for a living now.
Well, they're there. They do a lot of fundraising.
For their own campaigns. Yeah.
That's right.
And then real quick, one last, the Senate Judiciary marked up.
Oh, they marked up an immigration bill. That's right. There's 300 amendments. Ted Cruz wants to triple the number of Border Patrol agents, which would place 60 agents on the ground on the Mexican border.
Wow. 60,000, right?
Did I say, sorry,
60,000 agents.
That's right. That's a lot of agents.
Yeah, and we'll see this on our trip, but I just did a around-the-country trip a couple of months ago working on poverty issues, and I tripped along the border. I probably touched Mexico and actually crossed into Mexico at El Paso, but touched along Mexico about 6 or 8 times, and the 20,000 they have now, you really know they're there. I mean, there are checkpoints. It's like martial law, checkpoints, and the whole you can't throw a stone without hitting a border agent.
Well, Tom Hartman pointed out to me that there is a particular animal that needs to go back and forth. It's some kind of a leopard, and by this happening, the leopard is not getting to go and will probably die out.
It's just an animal. As long as banks don't die, they're the ones that are too big to fail.
He calls them banksters.
Hey, Ellen, what is it again? Goats for the Old Goat?
Goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Wonderful. I'll check that out. And
thank
Ellen,
you so much.
It's a treat having
hopefully
you on the show.
Hopefully I'll get thank to you. Meet you on the bus trip across.
I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Take care. That's the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk, and we'll be right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, May 9th. An eclipse of the sun will take place over a large swath of the Pacific Ocean on May 9th or 10th. Places to the east of the international dateline, such as the Hawaiian and Cook Islands, will see this eclipse in the afternoon hours today. Places to the west of the international dateline, southern Philippines, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, will find the sun in eclipse at sunrise or during the morning hours tomorrow.
A solar eclipse happens whenever the moon passes in front of the sun. The moon won't totally cover over the solar disk this time around, so it's absolutely essential to use proper eye protection throughout the whole eclipse. Come to our website for eye safety tips.
Parts of Australia, Papua New Guinea, the Solomon and Gilbert Islands will see the moon directly in front of the sun on May 10th. Unlike a total solar eclipse, the moon will be too far away to completely block out the sun's disk. So an annulus, or thin ring, of sunshine will surround the new moon silhouette during the annular stage of the eclipse.
Whereas a very small portion of the globe will witness an annular eclipse, a broad stretch of the Pacific will see a partial eclipse. During a partial eclipse, the moon only takes a bite out of the solar disk. Many Pacific islands will see the eclipse on May 9th or 10th, depending on which side of the international dateline they reside. Come to our website at earthsky.org for details. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you hugged a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant, cause they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican today.
That is fabulous. Brett, you're wonderful. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm in for Rick Smith on The Rick Smith Show. Just in time for Mother's Day, House Republicans successfully pushed through a bill aimed at mending the party's ailing standing with women voters. At least this is what they think. Working Families Flexibility Act, otherwise known as Bend Your Mother Over. Oh, no, not that kind of flexibility. Maybe not. They have a bill that's allowed employees to take time off instead of overtime pay. Are they going to let them take time and a half off instead of overtime pay? Or is it just you worked an extra hour here, you're not going to get overtime? And what the Republicans are saying, or at least the conservatives who are pushing this through, including Martha Roby, Republican from Alabama, what's this guy, Eric Cantor, Virginia, what they're saying is mommies don't need money, mommies need time. Women don't need money, women need time. This is how we're mending our fences with the women, we in the Republican Party. You want to mend the fence? Raise the minimum wage to $15. See, the problem is the majority of families in poverty are headed by women. So you cutting their pay by this ridiculous comp time stuff isn't going to help them at all. Now, there are five things you need to know about the comp time bill. Number one, comp time means a pay cut, a pay worker's pay cut. For workers' compensation with time off, rather than cash, they see a reduction in their take-home pay. Comp time means mandatory overtime. Comp time legislation would make mandatory overtime less expensive for employers. Under comp time legislation, employers may be able to receive benefits of overtime work at no additional cost themselves. Again, you're not getting time and a half off. Comp time means more unpredictable work schedules for employees, making mandatory overtime cheaper for employers. Would keep workers on the job longer and result in more unpredictable worker schedules. That's great for a mommy. What about child care? Comp time undermines the 40-hour work week. The only incentive for employees to maintain a 40-hour work week is the requirement in the Fair Labor Standards Act that says they have to pay time and a half. And then lastly, one of the five things you need to know about comp time, although I have a feeling if you're listening to the Rick Smith Show, you don't need to know any more about it than what you already know. Comp time is not voluntary. Workers can be coerced into the alternative time. And that is, that's not enough. We have a caller, and we have a little bit of time. So let's, shall we, is it Kristen? Kristen, great, okay. Hey, Kristen, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I'm not Rick, though,
hi.
I'm Pat. Hey.
Hi. This comp time is just a bunch of crap. It's absolute garbage, and it's going to be a nightmare for hourly workers. It's going to be a nightmare. I can just see it on the horizon. The employers are going to exploit us even more than they do now, and it's going to be a nightmare.
So, and if you're a person who ends up working 50 hours a week on a regular basis, at least you've got a fatter paycheck. At least you've got a chance of making your car payment. This time, you're going to have to work the 50 hours because it's non-negotiable. You want to keep your job, you're going to put in the 50 hours. You'll get your comp time. And you're not going to have any more to show for it, even though you might have had to pay more in daycare.
Absolutely. And I work in healthcare, and let me tell you what, I get $9 an hour. I saved a man's life this morning for $9 an hour.
Thank you.
And let me tell you what.
I know the thank you's not much, but I'm figuring that was nice.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I'm laying here in my bed listening to you, and my feet are swollen, and I'm exhausted because I worked overtime today, and yeah, I'm going to get woo time and a half at $9 an hour. Yay me. I don't want time off. I want to be compensated for the caliber of job that I do.
Now, I don't want you to tell anything because we certainly don't want you to get in trouble in your workplace, but do you have the option of organizing and getting a higher pay?
Absolutely not. When I was hired by this major healthcare corporation that is a huge employer in Cumberland County, we were shown an anti-union video. Huh. And we were told that if anybody approaches us about organizing, that we are not to engage them, that we are to come to the management.
You have to rat them out.
That behavior will not be tolerated.
So you, and obviously, you know, people don't just walk in and out of your facility, so it's not like the organizer could come into where you work, I'm thinking, unless they fake being a patient or something.
Oh, no. The only way that anybody would be able to organize is if one of us, one of the workers, tried to organize us. And that's what this video was about turning on your own coworkers. They want us to turn in each other. You know, if we decide we want to organize, we can't talk about it because we will be fired. That was the clear objective of that video. If you try to organize, you will be fired.
Wow.
We will not tolerate it.
Well, $9 an hour, that's almost $2 more than the minimum wage. I mean, what more could you want?
Oh, I don't know. I would think that all these rich people that send their elderly loved ones to us would value the people taking care of them a little more than that. But, you know, God forbid we're just feeding them, clothing them, housing them, and keeping them happy.
And alive.
And alive. Yeah, there is that.
Well, Kristen, I can't thank you enough for listening. And, you know, I think that is the point. If we all band together, and I know the some people are talking about a push for a minimum wage going to $9.50, I think the president said. And, you know, hallelujah.
Oh, gee, that means that I'll be back at a minimum wage job again.
Right.
Yay.
Hallelujah, but the point is that's not a living wage. And
it's not.
If people don't have the money that they need to spend, then the rest of the economy falters, as we have seen.
You're absolutely right.
Well, I'm glad you're tucked in. Sweet dreams. And make sure you listen to the Rick Smith Show, whether or not Pat LaMarche is here filling in for him.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Thanks, Kristen. You're hearing from a woman right now who she's making $9 an hour. She's working in the healthcare field. Oh, and by the way, the insurance premium you paid between you and your employer, if you have the insurance through your employer, was probably then more than she's going to make all month. So we've got profit in the middle of all the healthcare delivered in this country. You know, that's one of the reasons H.R. 676, which is so important, it's perennially put in or biennially put in. That's every 2 years, right? Biennially. It's biennially put in by Congressman Conyers from Michigan. And H.R. 676, Medicare for All, and supported by labor union after labor union after labor union. I mean, I get emails from them at least 2 to 3 a week about another major union that has signed on, because healthcare in the United States is just absolutely ridiculous. We pay the most and we die sooner. You might say it's okay to pay more if you live longer, but France pays less and lives longer. United Kingdom pays less, lives longer. Japan pays less, lives longer. Name it. Canada pays less, lives longer. Life expectancy in the United States, one of the lowest of all the industrialized nations, and we pay 3 times as much as the next closest competitor for our health care. We pay the most, and we die sooner. That's just a sign of absolutely bamboozled. And now they want to take away. I mean, literally, there wouldn't be a way to get secured, especially with the current Congress and the current state of politics. We couldn't secure ourselves the liberties that were fought for us by the labor movement over the last 100 years. We couldn't get the 40-hour week back if we lose it. We can't get rid of child labor. And when it comes to agricultural workers, we still have child labor. That 10-year-old in the field, that's legal. No minimum wage for agricultural workers. That's legal in the United States of America. We're going to be talking about this on our trip. I'm so excited to be going with Rick Smith, his beautiful family, his beautiful producer, Brett, who I absolutely love. I think we're related through hair, if no other place. And we're headed off on the People's Tour for America, and it's going to be great. And we hope that you'll tag along with us. We're going to broadcast all week long. Every week we're gone. And then in addition to that, there'll be all kinds of blog posts and writing and local coverage, and we're going to just travel the country. I'll be writing a book on the history of the labor movement, and we really want you to be along with us. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having a birthday. It was nice of you to take the night off and give me a chance to sit in the saddle for you. Brett, you're a fabulous, amazing guy, super smart, and he's taking care of it. Even the person I got him right back again. This is the Rick Smith Show, where people come to talk, working people come to talk, and Rick will be back Monday. Yeah, how do you like that? Thanks for joining us. I'm Pat LaMarche. This is the Rick Smith Show, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial mystery.